Welcome, everybody, to the Diecast Movie Podcast. For this episode, we have a special interview brought to you by my dad. Take it away, Dad.
Hello there, everybody. This is Steve from the Diecast Movie Podcast, and thanks for listening to our latest episode, which is going to be an interview of Bill Mulligan. Just to remind everybody that half our episodes are interviews, the other half are movie discussions where the die is cast to decide the genre of the movie we're going to discuss. And also, we're the home of Hammerama. So if you like Hammer films, those classic Hammer films up to the newer ones, pretty much you can tune in and listen. About every month, we have an episode of Hammerama come out. The last couple of months, we've had a little summer break with Hammerama. But those episodes are going to be starting up again soon. And in a minute, you're going to hear a promo for Hammerama, so you have an idea what to expect from Alistair Hughes and myself. On a programming note, I just want to say that this episode was recorded back in April, and it was supposed to come out back in April, but due to unforeseen circumstances, it's coming out now, so I apologize to Bill for the delay in the episode coming out, but it is out now, and I hope everybody enjoys it. And otherwise, we're going to listen to the Hammerama promo, and then we're going to go right into the interview of Bill and myself. Hope everybody enjoys it, and have a good day. Thank you.
I'm Al from New Zealand.
And I'm Stephen from Maryland, USA.
We are Hammerama. Welcome to our new podcast, Enter Freely. And of your own will.
Part of the multi-award-nominated diecast movie podcast, Hammerama is a wide look at the world of Hammer horror from either side of the globe.
Each month, we will throw a die to decide which category from the film Vault of Hammer we are going to discuss. The Dracula, Frankenstein, or Mummy Cycles, science fiction, prehistory, or the experimental 1970s.
We will cast our international eyes across then and now reviews of the movie,
its place in the Hammerverse,
our encounters with the stars,
a film poster critique,
and unusual associated merchandise.
So join us for our bite-sized discussion of Hammer's gory glories, stitched together from both ends of the earth.
Hammerama is a proud part of the Diecast Movie Podcast. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest episode of the Diecast Movie Podcast, where we do movie discussions where the genre is decided by the roll of a die, and we also do interviews. And today I am fortunate enough to have an interview for all you with Bill Mulligan, who's an actor, writer, filmmaker, and what I hear, an all-around nice guy.
That's just a rumor, though.
How you doing today, Bill?
Doing okay. Thanks so much for having me on. This is great.
And I also left out, you're also a co-host of Decades of Horror, the 80s and the 70s, two of the great years or decades of horror.
Yeah. And that's really been awesome. And especially during the COVID years when podcasting was pretty much the only creative outlet that a lot of us had. Conventions were gone. Filmmaking was dead. Yeah. Those things were really a lifeline. And it's interesting that the fans I think we made during the COVID years have really stuck with us. I mean, you know, there's no sugarcoating. It was awful all around, but some good did come out of the situation in that it did bring a lot of fans together. And I think also made us all appreciate what we had, which we were taking for granted before then. So.
Oh, I definitely think so. And it's one of the things that was missing for the 2-year period was the human interaction. I can only imagine if this would have happened, it did happen back with the Spanish flu. And you had no technology like we did nowadays where you can actually communicate still with people. And then you're taking more of a risk to go and do that communication with the old school method. So in some ways we were better off, in other ways we were worse off. But
yeah,
it's always interesting when you compare to past history.
Hopefully the last one I'll have to go through in my lifetime. But who knows, these things can happen whenever they decide to happen.
That is true.
It's a real life horror movie.
That is true. Well, real life is always the most horrific thing than the fantasy worlds, but people love watching, as you specialize more in horror films with your podcast and stuff like that, you know, people go there to get that release. People are like, why do people like horror films? My thing is to get that release from the real life.
Right. It'd be interesting to see how this will affect horror movies going forward. I mean, besides the obvious, there have been some movies that very specifically were like Zoom meeting movies and you know, talking about plagues and stuff. But just in terms of the general zeitgeist and all, you know, what monsters are going to take over? What's the overall theme? Isolation, mental illness, you know, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. And there'll be creators who can grab onto that and take some germ of an idea and apply it. I mean, I hope they don't just do COVID movies because that will be dated. They're already dated. My wife has started watching some TV shows set in a fire engine house, and there's the whole season where everybody's wearing masks. And it really does take you out of the picture because it's so, it, even though it's been relatively recent vintage, it feels dated already.
Yeah, anytime movies or TV shows go topical, they have a small lifespan where if you look back at the older movies and TV shows that my children and your children and you know eventually our grandchildren can watch, they have that they're always able to be watched. They're like perennials, you know. They can just constantly.
I think that's fascinating. I started writing a script after Hurricane Katrina. It was basically a zombie Hurricane Katrina movie. And about halfway through, you know, it was like already people aren't talking about Hurricane Katrina anymore. It's like, you know, it's fascinating watching the Hammer movies, how they deliberately updated everything with Dracula AD 1972, because they were like, well, the old gothics are kind of dated. There is nothing more dated than the parts of Dracula AD 72, where they're trying to show you, you know, the hip, cool year of 1972. That movie was dated by 1973. The hippies look way more old fashioned than the, Gothic people in the Victorian costumes look. Setting something in the past does give it an ageless quality because it always is supposed to look aged. And I'm surprised more people don't do historical horror, except the obvious, the costumes, the sets, all that. But you take just about any monster and say, we're going to make a zombie movie. It's like, okay, a zombie movie. It's going to take place during the building of the pyramids of Egypt. I'm like, I am suddenly intrigued. Yeah, how would the ancient Egyptians have dealt with a zombie plague? And does that explain some of the, oh, okay. Then you start getting into, is that what mummies are all about? Is that what the pyramids were really for? Suddenly the story ideas start coming to you. And now that I'm saying this, that actually sounds like a pretty good premise. But boy, I sure couldn't make it on the budgets I'm used to working with.
Well, that's true. I mean, when you have an independent small budget, but imagine, what is it? Like, wasn't it the Mayan civilization that just disappeared and nobody can explain why? So those are the ones that are really tantalizing to come up with those stories about how that happened.
I mean, they practically write themselves. And but the sets and all are a problem. But that's getting less and less now because the technology of filmmaking is it's changing so fast you can't even keep up with it. I'm amazed at some of the technology that's available to everybody now. And I think it's really exciting. Now, some people are spooked by it. Everyone is just panicking about AI, that AI is going to, you know, AI art is going to replace artists. I may be wrong. I don't think it is at all because I've seen this before. People are like, Photoshop is going to replace photography. No, because people who are good in photography are going to learn to use Photoshop to make their stuff look better. Yes, amateurs like myself can also now make photographs that look cool, but nothing compared to what people who are already good at the art are able to do with this new tool. Geniuses will always be better at using these new tools than amateurs will be. It's just inevitable. They will figure it out. And computer art's cool, but for most of us, it takes a long time to figure out how to get the decent something out of computer art. And I'm willing to bet that these artistic types are going to figure that out real fast and use it as a tool for supplementing, you know, doing things just the way like animation, cartoon animation, Disney started using computers to do some of the boring work of making clockworks and stuff. There's no reason to have a human being drawing that when a computer can do it just as well. But I don't see the computer yet being able to capture the nuances of expression and things that humans have. Maybe they'll get to that. Maybe.
Well, I think that's been a common fear since the Industrial Revolution.
We were always going to be replaced. Yeah. And of course, that was, you know, you can look back at films like Metropolis and so on from all the way up, if you go film history, we're always going to be replaced. The Terminator movies, every, you know, there's always that fear that technology is going to get rid of all of us. And it's right. just, and this is just the newest thing, but it's also been used in past things. So it's hard to say if it's really like new or technology is finally catching up to the fantasy. Mm-hmm. It's hard to say.
Yeah. I'm not worried yet. I mean, they're saying, oh, they're going to replace us as writers. I've seen some of the writing that computers do, and it reads like well-written technical manuals. It certainly doesn't have that zing that a good fiction writer or a poet can have. But you know what? Listen, if the computers actually turn out they can do everything that we can do just as well, I guess that'll just be when we sit back and just watch movies that are made by computers and they're the best thing ever, and read books written by computers and they're totally awesome. And, you know, okay. That's fine.
Yeah. Well, we'll see.
We had a good run.
We'll see how it plays out, you know, as time goes by. It's the only thing you can do. You can fear the future, or you can just go enjoy the present.
It's
going to
come whether you're afraid of it or not. So you might as well just embrace the horror.
Well, that's one way to put it, embrace the horror, or just embrace the change. Change is the only constant.
That's right. That's true throughout ever. But every generation feels like they are the first generation to experience these things. You know, I have to laugh when I see, you know, romantic love didn't really exist, you know, until recently, because in the Middle Ages, everything was an arranged marriage. And they're like, you're talking about kings and queens. The vast majority of people are like the vast majority of people now. They met someone, they fell in love, they got married, they had kids, they died at 40 from some horrible disease that they blamed on cats. And, you know, come on, humans we're more like the humans of 1,000 years ago than we think we are. We just like to think they were a bunch of butt-scratching cavemen. They were smarter than we were. They built all their cool stuff without knowing why it worked. That's amazing to me. They invented gunpowder without having even the inkling of understanding of chemistry. So I teach high school science, chemistry and physics, physical science, biology occasionally. Earth science and everything. So science and history have always been my two favorite subjects. I guess that's why I love the idea of historical horror movies, because I love horror movies and I love history, and I wish there were more of the two coming together.
So you're like a modern day alchemist.
But I get why they don't do it. Oh yeah. Oh, the alchemist. Yeah. See, what would the alchemist do when faced with some unknown? They'd probably start messing around with mercury, because that was always their go-to. And then they die horribly. It's like, if only he'd used more mercury.
Well, you know, and of course people used to use bloodletting. You know, we got to get the bad blood out so the good blood will take its place. So, I mean, it's...
Well, you know, we laugh at those people, but I got to say, COVID has shown that the same thing happens. I'm sure what happened is that someone went into the barber, because that's where you went to when you were feeling bad, with high blood pressure, and the barber cut him and let some blood out, and the guy felt better because it relieved the blood pressure. And that's fine. And from that point on, everybody was convinced that literally everything that could happen to you, including loss of blood, could be improved by losing some more blood. And that's the problem. People take this one little bit of information and they extrapolate it to be this grand unifying theory of reality. And that's not the case.
Everybody always likes to make things a simple answer, but as we know, the world is not black and white. It's multiple shades of gray.
But Often the simple answer is this incredible conspiracy theory that requires hundreds of thousands of people to be in on it, and the media and the governments and everyone else. And you're just like, do you look at the governments of the world? They don't have the competence to have pulled off this incredible, well-written, I got to say, it's well-plotted. Some of these conspiracy theories, you can get sucked into it. It's like, yeah, that does make a lot of sense. But what they're doing is they're taking things that have already happened and fitting it into this theory. But that's true for a lot of science too. A lot of people, you know, this explains, you know, climate change. It's like, okay, cool. Can you put it into a model that will predict what's going to happen in the future? And that hasn't been nearly as successful. It's very easy to come up with a model that explains the past, but it's only as good as it's able to predict the future. And those have not been as good.
Yeah.
So
as we both know, from probably those days, and I'm sure you probably did it like I did, and watched Leonard Nimoy's In Search Of, and you would hear these different things back then. And then you look back, I got the old episodes. Every so often I'll put one of them in, and I'll be like, according to, you know, scientists then, this was going to happen already, but it didn't happen. You couldn't, as you said, the projections are not always... Basically, you're taking the input, the data you have already prior, and you're projecting what the future is going to be. But if the data changes in the future, like what's going to come into the future, then all the projections are wrong, and that's been the problem. It's just it's hard to predict the future.
I spent the first half of my life convinced that any day now we were going to find proof of the Loch Ness Monster, and I've spent the last half of my life upset that it hasn't happened and probably never will happen. I've had to admit that. I know. Bigfoot. I still hold out hope for Bigfoot. I still hold out hope that there could be some reality to either Bigfoot or the Yeti or the Orang Pendak or some of these other relic hominids, that there could be something there. Every day that goes by that we don't have proof is another nail in my coffin for this hope, but.
For listeners that can't see it, because we can't see it because we're doing an audio podcast, I pointed to my hat, which has "I still believe," and it has Bigfoot going across. And I just remember, the Legend of Boggy Creek and some other movies that came out back then. And when I was at the right age, and you just from that point on, and of course, the $6 Million Man with Bigfoot, you always have that belief.
Oh yeah, Andre the Giant. Yeah.
Yeah, you can't. I was hit at the right age.
Audio only. I can't believe I showered and shaved for this.
Oh, you did.
Yeah, I don't even. I put on pants. Oh well. You're grateful for that, if no one else. So that worked that well.
Yeah, at least you smell good, over Zoom. That'd be the future of Zoom. Smell vision, which I'm sure would have been terrible for a lot of people.
I've always liked that. I love old science fiction movies where, they show in the future, the phones will allow you to see and smell people. Like, who would want that? But of course, that used to be a big joke. Yeah, they always predicted we'd have telephones where you could see people, but then they never thought to ask, do people really want to be seen? And a lot of us didn't. But now, of course, that turned out to be a complete laughable lie. We totally want to be seen. It's the phone, the Zoom meetings and FaceTiming and everything else. That's just the way to go.
Well, I think it helps with the interaction for us as humans to interact with everybody. You like to be able to see the person, because when you hear something, if you break down communication, you get a text message or an email, then you're wondering, well, what did they really mean? I can't really hear their vocal inflections. Then you hear their voice and you're like, okay, but I didn't really see him. So what he being, I heard their voice, but I'm still wondering. Then when you can see, hear, and everything put together, you're able to get more of an idea of the exact point the person was trying to get across. And I think
how many internet fights do we have because you can't tell if someone's being sarcastic or something? He's like, somebody will say something and the next person comes on, how dare you? And it's like, wait, I wasn't even talking to you. I just haven't figured out how Twitter works. And I was replying to someone up there. And it's social media has caused a lot of trouble. As a teacher, you see it in real time, just how rough it's been. But there's no putting that genie back in the bottle. They're talking about banning Twitter for anyone under 16, banning social media for anyone under 16. It's like, good luck with that. Yeah, well, good luck.
Well, Twitter, for under 16, they don't use that anyway. They go to TikTok and all the other stuff. And who knows?
Right.
And actually, we're probably behind the time now. It's probably already something else. And we just haven't been told yet, because you and I are of a different generation. We get told eventually as it moves up through the ranks to get to us old guys. But
just another case of old people spoiling things for kids, like we do with Halloween. When I was a kid, Halloween was a kid's holiday. Adults tolerated it. They went out and bought some candy and threw it in things. And as my generation got older, we just took Halloween with us. We got to that age where you're supposed to stop doing things for Halloween. We're like, oh, no. Now we're going to smut it up and make it an adult holiday. So you go to the store now to buy a costume for your kids. You got to go past the, slutty witch, slutty nurse, slutty astronaut, which still boggles my mind. Slutty astronaut, actual costume. I'm like, wow, you've really, that's great. But it's a grown up holiday, and they, we'll have something over here for the kids. Like, like second only to Christmas. I love it. I mean, I love Halloween. I'm glad it grew up with me. I would have hated to abandon it. But I do feel like we've taken away a lot from the kids. Kids used to have Saturday morning and Halloween and all these little things, and just bit by bit, they've been snatched away from them.
Exactly. Now, speaking of childhood, going back to when you were growing up, back in the old days, you know.
People can't see my pictures. So they don't know how old this old fart is. I'm 62 years old. So I was born in 1960. I grew up in the 60s.
You're as old as my eldest brother, and you are nowhere near the oldest person I interviewed. You're a youngster.
Oh, well, okay.
The oldest person I interviewed was 102. So
holy wow, who's that?
Nehemiah Persoff. I interviewed him, and then a few months later, he sadly passed away. But obviously, he lived a long, full life, and he was a wonderful person to talk with. And
that's awesome.
Yeah, but he you talk about a guy who had a career. He had a career that people mm-hmm. would just kill for. I mean, all the different stuff he was in, character actor, tons and tons of TV work and movies and theater. But what led to you getting started down this path of going into film? What was that, you know, when you were growing up, what was your thing, your jam?
Three words, stop motion animation. The first film I remember seeing from the crib was The Black Scorpion, Willis O'Brien's Black Scorpion. And then very quickly, I think it was one of those things like the 4:30 movie or something, and they had a montage of film bits at the beginning, and they included the skeleton sequence from Jason and the Argonauts. And I'm like, what is this thing from? And we didn't have much back. We didn't have the internet, obviously. You had Famous Monsters of Film Land and books that, you know, you could maybe check out the library. And I was just searching and searching. And I just remember finding a still from Jason and the Argonauts. Now I had a name to go with it. And that's what it was like. And listen, every old person will tell you, back when I was a kid, things were better. That's a lot of horse crap. But if I'd had the internet back then, I would have had the complexion of a mushroom, because I never would have left the room. I would have just been absorbing all these things. All that said, there is something about not having comic book stores. If you wanted a comic book, you had to go to drugstore after drugstore to find what they had and try to find the one that hadn't been bent back on the horrible metal thing that they kept it on. If you wanted to watch a particular movie, you didn't have a VCR, not until fairly late in the game. You had to stay up late. And most of these genre movies were on late. Saturday would have Creature Features at 12 and Chiller Theater at 11 afternoon, and then another Chiller Theater at 11 at night, and then usually something buried at 2 o'clock in the morning. Way too late for me to stay up, so I set my alarm clock. And you wake up, you're the only person awake in the house. Go into the living room, keep the noise down so you're not disturbing people, and you're watching a horror movie in a darkened house because you can't turn lights on. Yeah, that was, but there was some ownership there. It was different. When I became a comic book collector, and I was for quite a while, and the comic book stores opened, I could tell the difference already. Going there and having them have saved the book for you, and here's your stack of comics for the week and everything, it wasn't the same. You didn't have that sense of accomplishment that you search. It's the difference between going to a store and buying a fish and going fishing. There's a difference. And people who aren't fishermen were like, why are you doing this when you can just go there and get, you know, like you just don't get it. It's different when you catch something yourself, when you find something. There's a difference between running around to antique stores looking for something. You don't even know why. You're just exploring. When you find something, it's like buried treasure. Mm-hmm. Or going on eBay and searching buried treasure, and there's a bunch of stuff. There's no comparison.
It's the thrill of the hunt.
Would I go back to those days?
The thrill of the hunt.
Yeah. Yes. Would I go back to those days? Not in a million years would I go back to those days. Come on, stop. No, of course not. But having grown up in those days, this is the best of all possible worlds. You grew up having to work for things. And then when you get older and you don't have the energy you have, it's okay because, you know, society now will hand it to you. But, well, that's it. That's perfect. I lucked out. Maybe if I'd been born just a little bit earlier, I would appreciate even more, just, you know, maybe mid-50s or so. But I'm pretty happy. And I think everyone should be happy with the time they were born, because you can't change it.
Yep.
Just be aware that by the time you get to my age, you will probably be thinking, oh, my God, this music, it's just noise. Things were so much better when dot, 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 dot. That's an old line that has been used by every generation, and it's probably true for every individual person. That's what got me. Stop motion animation, and specifically Ray Harryhausen. I became obsessed with Ray Harryhausen, found out how he did these things, started doing some myself with Super 8, which was a fun medium to work with. And by fun, I mean, oh God, it was awful. But it was very creative and, you know, very limited. There was a lot of limits on what you can do. And when you're limited, you have to get clever. And now, oh my God, the special effects that you can do with Adobe After Effects and everything, it's marvelous. And there's still lots of room for cleverness. You know, go on YouTube now. That was the other thing. No one gave away their secrets. Ray Harryhausen, he was like, you know, he did not give away any of his tricks. People have to try to figure it out and everything. And now you go on YouTube and there's how-tos, you know, point by point on how to achieve some of these effects. So these low-budget films, I help run a film festival for Con Carolinas. If anyone out there has some short films, genre films, go to Film Freeway and look up Con Carolinas and send us your film. We'd love to see them. This is our 13th year. The technical quality of the films from 13 years ago to now, wow, what an explosion of competence and technological achievement. You're looking at stuff like this is better. I mean, not just a little better, way better than, say, the original Star Trek. In fact, now I'm seeing stuff that's better than Next Generation. I'm seeing special effects from people who spent virtually no money and are making stuff that looks better than $1 million Hollywood production could have come up with back in the day. That's pretty cool.
I think that's one of the wonderful things about technology nowadays. There's a couple I interviewed, Matthew and Tori Butler Hart. They did a film during the pandemic in England, Infinitium Subject Unknown. And he used his iPhone and gimbal. And they'd always done films before with the normal cameras and that kind of stuff. But they were like, well, you know, they're stuck. It's just the two of them. They're married, so they can do the shots and all these things. And they went about and shot this wonderful film. And they had Sir Ian McKellen and another person. Wow. I'm trying to remember another person. He's also from Game of Thrones. He played the bald guy, the eunuch. I can't remember his name off the top.
Oh, yeah. But, Varys.
And so they both videoed themselves, and they're in there for small little parts, you know, to give the backstory. And it's just wonderful science fiction movie. And they also went around so smartly, taking advantage of the pandemic and going around the empty streets and locations that you could never afford on a low budget. And here they are able to do that to show that the deafness, the deadness, the lack of population, and that kind of thing. And it's really well done. But yeah, if you have a camera, especially if you have a camera, you know, your phone and a gimbal, so it has that steadiness, and you get the good sound with it and everything. And all you got to do is just get some inexpensive lighting. Mm-hmm. Their film actually was shown in theaters and that kind of stuff, and it's just really, really well done. So
yeah, produce good things. I would recommend to people who are looking to get into filmmaking, don't underestimate the sound. That we get way more films that get rejected strictly because of sound than any other reason. If you had a choice between a super expensive camera lens that's going to make everything just look beautiful, bright and shiny, and a really good sound system, go for the sound system. It doesn't have the glamour because film is a visual medium. A bad sound takes you immediately out and there's no recovery. You know, bad visuals can actually work for you. If you're doing, say, a found footage movie, it should not look like it was filmed with a red camera. So, you know, really pay attention to the sound. That is a killer. I can't tell you how many films you get. And it breaks your heart when you get a short film for submission where they have a great idea. And even more importantly, they took their great idea and they actually made a good story out of it, because a lot of people don't know the difference between an idea and a story. And all that's working, but when they're like, when you are listening to a dialogue scene and you're cutting back from one character to the other, you can tell that the one time when they're shooting this character, there's a lot of cars going by. And when they go to the next one, there's silence in the background. Then back to this character and the cars are back. And then back to this one, suddenly there's a cricket. And you're like, ooh. And I know sound's a nightmare to work with sometimes, but that just instantly takes you out of the story. Film is almost a hypnosis. And if you're working, if you're not doing things like breaking the 180 rule or doing things that jar people, they're kind of absorbed in there. Time is passing by and they're not even aware of it. But as soon as you do something like that, it reminds them, oh, this is a film. And, you know, they snap out of it and that hypnosis is broken. So yeah, sound, please take a look at it. And you know what, if you've shot a film and you didn't do that and you're looking back, it's like, why is this not getting accepted? It might be the sound. The one good thing about sound is you can fix it in post, but you really don't want to fix it in post. That was one thing of one of our films, actually, fix it in post, because that's like the biggest in joke among indie filmmakers. When anything goes wrong, when anything's not going the way it should, it's like, we'll fix it in post, which sometimes you can and sometimes you can't, but you'd never want to fix it in post ever, because it's usually a big problem.
It sometimes can work for you. You and I have seen many films where you can tell they couldn't fix it in post. It was just because you're looking at the finished product. I agree with you on sound. And the other thing, I think a lot of filmmakers, whether young filmmakers or inexperienced or even experienced filmmakers, because you'll see these ideas, they have this great idea. And it'd be perfect for a 10 to 15 minute short. And they will stretch that puppy out. And you're just going through, and it's just padding. It's like, what are you doing? Your idea, if you would have kept it at that 15 minute mark, you would have had some gold. But instead, you now have an hour ish, and it's tedious. You're thinking of one, even though it might only be an hour and 5 minutes. You're thinking you've been there for days, and that's the worst thing I think a film could ever be, is boring.
Well, boring is the absolute worst thing. It's the worst thing in life, I think. Bad, horrible pain is the worst thing in life. But boring is about the worst thing that people like ourselves, who are normally comfortable, have to deal with. Let me put it this way. There's never been a short film where the reviewers, the judges, have all said, I wish this was longer, that didn't get into the festival. That's like one of the best compliments you can get. I wish it were longer. I'd like to see more of these characters. But that's the thing. Yes. And I don't understand it. The nice thing about making indie films is there aren't any real rules about how you have to do it. Hollywood has rules. They're not going to let a person in Hollywood make, unless they're, Martin Scorsese, make a black and white film or make a film that has a running time of 42 minutes. What would that be? Who would want that? You have the luxury of making your film exactly the way you want, looking the way you want, for as long as you want it. And the length that you should want is the length it takes to tell the story, and not a moment more or a moment less. Unless there's some constraint in the nature of the film, like if you're doing one of the 48-hour film festivals where they say the film has to be no more than 7 minutes. Okay, well, there's your limit, 7 minutes. But 7 minutes is a lot to actually fill up in a movie you're making from start to finish in 48 hours. Just do that. But a lot of times you'll be watching these short films and it's not very good. And then it has a killer ending. And you realize the ending was, that's what they had. They came up with an idea for a great ending and they decided to jump in and make a movie with that ending. And it's like, if you had just spent a little more time, thought this over a little bit more and came up with a story worthy of this ending, it makes me upset because I'll be watching. It's like, I can already imagine in my mind a better movie than this with that ending, but I can't do it, of course, because, just be ripping this person off and you don't want to do that. But you'll be watching a film sometimes, or sometimes you're watching a film and they have everything good but the ending. Mm-hmm. There's a good end. There's an obvious ending. You can see it coming and you're like, I can see this ending coming, but it's a good ending. And then it doesn't happen. You're like, wow, what? You didn't see this obvious way to conclude this great story that you have going?
And then they'll use that line, we were trying to subvert your expectations. I'm like, no. Sometimes that works. But for me, most of the time, it doesn't work. I think if you're leading the audience this path And it could have a, and it could be a path with, where it could, you could hit a fork in the road. It could go two different ways. And I love movies that end that way, where it could go, you can interpret one way or the other. I'm fine with that. But you want to stick the landing, because that's what everybody's leaving with.
Yeah.
And I totally agree with you. I've said this many times. If I'm leaving a movie and I wanted more, I don't need a sequel. I don't, because some people say, oh, don't you wish there was a sequel to this movie or whatever. Like, no, I'm happy. I'm fine with wanting more, you know, because that just means you had a good time. Or if they can somehow nail the spot that nobody can nail, where you're left exactly right on the spot where you're like, you don't need more, but it's not too long. And that varies from everybody to everybody, you know. So it's an impossible spot to hit, except for maybe one person out of a million. You always want to leave them wanting more.
I'm not a big fan of the subverting expectations thing, because so often it's just used as a crutch for not good storytelling. It's very easy to subvert expectations. Now, sometimes it is good when you have what seems to be a damsel in distress, but then it turns out, well, it usually turns out she's a werewolf or a vampire. Tell you the truth, that's kind of been done to death, but it's one I've always kind of liked, where, you know, the person that we think is going to be the victim turns out to be actually the predator. It's a cliche, but it's a fun cliche and all. But a lot of this subverting expectation is just the expectation that we, the audience, have is that we're going to enjoy this movie. That's the expectation we have. When you subvert that, you make an unenjoyable movie, you know, a movie that is not enjoyable. And that's nothing to pat yourself on the back over. I did not like the last Halloween movie. It was like, well, we subverted expectations. You thought Michael Myers was going to be in it, and we didn't even see him until halfway through the movie. It's like, okay, is that really the formula for a good Halloween movie? I don't think so. I mean, you replaced it with something else. Yes, definitely not what I expected, but so what? I mean, there's a lot of things you can do that are unexpected, and they're not good. There's a reason why formulas do work. I mean, formulaic movies can be tedious to a degree. I think an awful lot of the stuff that's coming out of Hollywood, it's just so predictable. You can, you know, beat by beat, you can see it. But there's also something to be said for formula. Introduction, establish the conflict, resolve the conflict. You know, I mean, I guess you could say it backwards. There's a few films that have been interesting in kind of reversing time and things. But boy, that's a one-trick pony. You can't do that very often. You know, now I do think too many people, there's a wonderful book called Save the Cat, which tells you how to write screenplays. I would recommend any screenwriter, anyone who wants to write screenplays, read it. I do not recommend that anyone who just likes to watch movies read it, because when you do, you will never unsee it. And the whole the save the cat thing is that early in the film, in the first few minutes, you show the character, even if this character is not necessarily a good person, do something redeemable, something that shows them to be, okay, we instantly like them. Will Smith is down on his luck going for a job interview, but he stops to put a few coins in the cup of a beggar or something. Okay, so here we like Will Smith. He's a nice guy. There's a little girl with a cat stuck up in the tree, and the guy, even though he's brusque and everything else, there's something that touches his heart. He brings the cat down, and then the cat pisses on his suit. And we get a laugh moment, but we still establish that this is a good guy who would save a cat. Well, you start seeing that in everything, even movies where the whole premise is, you know, Jim Carrey is going to be zapped with some magic wish that means he can't tell a lie or something. He's a bad person, but by the end of the movie, he will have learned to be a good dad, blah, 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 blah. Very formulaic, but it was fun. You know, you see that they have something that redeems them. They love their kid. They're just bad at being a father, but they do love their kid. That's something we can work with and go on that. Yes, it's very formulaic, but it works. That's what we want to see. We want to see characters. I mean, that's another thing. Your characters should change from when we first meet them to when we say goodbye. Characters that are the same all the way through, less interesting, unless they're meant to be like some kind of force of nature, or maybe they're not really the protagonist. They're the thing that causes change in other people. You know, I mean, there are obvious exceptions. I mean, I'm saying this, I'm wondering, is there really any great change in, say, the Clint Eastwood spaghetti westerns, The Man with No Name? Is he any different at the end than he was in the beginning? And probably not, but I always saw him as almost like a metaphor for death. He comes into town, And by the time it's over, the town is way smaller, a lot less people, you know, bad guys have been taken care of and everything. So there has been change. He's just sort of a angel of death or something that comes in there. He himself hasn't changed much.
Yeah, I don't think there is a Clint Eastwood movie with, I don't think any of the spaghetti Westerns ones does he change. And I'm trying to think like Pale Rider. He's definitely doesn't change there. Cause he's an angel of death, as you put it exactly in that movie. So pretty much in all
and
the
that could
ones,
be, that could be,
it's all the same.
Which is, they're kind of like high class slasher movies, you know, a bunch of stupid kids come in, just living life, taking drugs, having sex, and like there's no tomorrow. Oh, there is no tomorrow because the slasher shows up and kills everyone except maybe the one person who changes. And their change, I guess, is basically they've learned the world is a horrible place where you've got to always be aware and also don't split up. That's always a mistake. What are you thinking, split up?
Well, you know, the 80s trope, don't have sex, don't do the drugs, and you'll make it through the movie, you know, and so you don't really change. They never did that to begin with, so they just stayed good, where the rest of the people succumbed to whatever the killer went to off them for.
That's kind of another new trope that can be good but can also be overused, where the characters are aware of the tropes. Scream is the one that probably did it best, where they're, you know, oh, no, if we split up, they say, don't split up, then they don't split up and they just get, you know, killed anyway. And then the ultimate one, and it was one of my favorites. I love Cabin in the Woods. Cabin in the Woods was so much fun, but it didn't do well. It did. In fact, it did very poorly, especially considering how good it was. And I think that's some resistance that audiences don't like being told that the things they love are kind of stupid. If you think about them. Yeah. Everything's stupid. It's like, you know, and if you take almost anything and synthesize it down to its essence, it doesn't make a lot of sense. My favorite writer growing up was Harlan Ellison. He always got a big laugh. He's like, you know, what's the story of Moby Dick? A nut chasing after a big fish. You know, I mean, basic storylines can be pretty simple and dopey. It's what you do with them. And the self-aware movies where it's like we know we're in a movie and or the characters are seemingly aware and winking at the audience like we know what's going on. A little of that can go a long way. I do like the Scream movies. But I think they've gone to that well as many times as they need to go. I'm not chomping at the bit to watch the next one and the next one and the next one and the next one.
Oh, I agree with you.
Eventually
everything runs its course.
Yeah, what would be, you know, then we're going to have a Scream movie where the director is going to subvert our expectations and it's basically just a regular slasher movie with, you know, it turns out the killer is just some faceless guy wearing a mask and has no reason to do any of the things. There's no connection with any of the characters. You're like, well, this isn't much like a Scream movie. It's like, that's right. I subverted your expectations. I made a Friday the 13th movie instead. Praise me. I'm like, yeah, shut up. Because the people who like Scream movies want to see a Scream movie. They don't want to see a Friday the 13th movie.
And the people like Friday
people
the 13th.
Go to see Friday the 13th.
Exactly.
They don't want to see a bunch of characters from a Scream movie who are aware. And I guess that's what hurt Jason X, that Jason X was kind of a Scream movie fused with science fiction, fused with Friday the 13th. And tell you the truth, I kind of liked it. Nobody seems to love that movie at all. But since I'm not a big fan of Friday the 13th, I'm not a big fan of slasher movies, I'm willing to have fun, you know, with a movie that just takes it to its ultimate, Jason in space. Like, good God, give me a break. But, you know, once you accept that, if you're watching the movie, if you chose to watch Jason in space over all the other choices you have, just go for the ride. Enjoy it for what it is. They didn't lie to you. It's space and Jason's there. He's an unkillable zombie. We can throw him into the Earth's atmosphere. He can burn up to a tiny little husk. And he makes Deadpool look like, you know, Miss Daisy. He just comes right back from whatever little tiny atom of Jason is left. He's going to grow right back. Okay.
I love it when movies have the title and they show you the trailer and the movie is exactly what you expected it to be. The most recent example. Cocaine Bear. But Snakes on a Plane.
Brilliant.
Hobo with a Shotgun. Yeah. I mean, these are movies that you just, you know, right off the title, what to expect. Yeah. And they deliver. And you leave with a smile and you're just kind of like, I was entertained. I was happy. They are like the ultimate B movie. You go in, you're not expecting Oscar material here. You're expecting to be thoroughly entertained. And if you saw the trailer, my thing is like with Cocaine Bear, if you saw the trailer and you enjoyed that trailer, I've seen it. My eldest son, seen it twice. And if you enjoyed the trailer, you're going to enjoy that movie. You know exactly what it's going to happen, and you're going to leave. You're going to be entertained.
As long as the filmmakers are honest. Now, if I go to see Cocaine Bear, and it turns out that there is a bear who snorts cocaine, but really it's about a mom and her daughter connecting, and it's just a whole lot of yap yap yap, and not a whole lot of roar roar roar. I'm going to be a little upset. I feel like they did a bait and switch. I'm always amazed when filmmakers do that. They like the movie My Giant, where it's a sad movie about this guy who finds a giant. It was based on Andre the Giant, Billy Crystal. And you know, it's a sad story because, you know, he's got a bad heart. We know how this is going to end. But the trailer was whackety-schmackety-doo. It was just all kinds of slapstick. And, oh, it's funny. It's a guy finds a giant. And it's like, oh, I'm going to bring the kids. I don't want to see a movie about, you know, this is a movie about a dog that comes in and changes the family life. And then halfway through the movie, he dies. Okay, if it's Old Yeller, if you save it for the ending, yes, I get it. That's a gut punch, but it's going to, you know, it chokes me up even now. Old Yeller, good God. But no, don't subvert, because word gets out. That's the other thing. Word gets out now. You go there and it's like, the movie, the trailer made it seem like it was a really scary movie, and actually it's not at all. So maybe you'll get that first weekend, but then a swift death. And there's no point in doing that.
And the word got out even to movies back before the internet days. People were like, oh, come down because of the internet. No, I remember, you and I both remember days when a movie came out, your friends that saw it would go back to the schoolyard or whatever, and you all of a sudden hear, you know, boom. And it was just, and it would be, nobody would go see it the next weekend. It was gone. And then somebody else would come and replace it. So it nowadays it happens at a quicker pace.
Right.
But of course people.
That's one of the differences.
Some people say it on purpose. Some people purposely do it. So you got to be careful where you're listening to. You have to go with your trusted sources.
One of the big disadvantages now is that every fool with a keyboard, which is everyone, every single one of them, has as much power as any other critic, which dilutes them somewhat. I will say I'm a little suspicious. It's got at the point now when, you know, I'll see an article and it's like, the internet erupts in fury as Disney reveals that the new Tinkerbell is black. It's like, really? The internet is erupting? And then you read the article and it's like, Riot Girl 795 said this. Like, who the hell is she? No one. You can go out and find any, you want any opinion on any topic, go on Twitter, go on whatever, and you can drag out 100 of them. 100 people out of, what are we up to, 320 million? Who gives a rat's ass? I don't know who these people are. They mean nothing to me. If a politician says it, okay, well, this is someone of some note. If a critic for a leading magazine, if there are any more, says it, okay, sure. But randos on the internet, yes, there's always going to be a bunch of them upset about something. Every single thing, on the right, on the left, in the middle, there are these people, they live their lives just to write this thing that you like, you should not like it. And then they give their dopey reasons.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm searching through, if I read these, I stop reading them because what's the point? I'm looking for, where in this article is any reason why I need to listen to this person? What is your level of expertise? Why should I listen to you? Especially if you're telling me something, I shouldn't like something. Oh, I like something. Something gives me enjoyment and you want to take that away from me. Boy, there better be some compelling reasons. Because I'm not one of these folks who's easily led just because one person who, again, you've never heard of is telling you to stop doing something. Why would you listen?
Yeah. Well, my theory has always been is
become an industry.
My theory has always been, there's a movie I might love that you might hate, vice versa. Hey, I'm just telling you, like when we talk about movies and we do a movie discussion, just like on your podcast, you know, it's the same thing. This could be somebody's sacred cow, you know, this movie they love. Mm-hmm. And I just don't get it, or vice versa. And I'm fine with that. Yeah. Hey, that's why there's millions of movies out there, because there's so many of us, and I haven't seen all of them. And enjoy your stuff. Yes. I'll enjoy my stuff.
Yeah.
And, but you know, I'm never going to say that they're dumb or stupid. I'm just saying you just have different taste to that movie than I do.
I was on a panel once. Oh, I went to see a panel. I wasn't on it. Thank God I wasn't on it. And it was a panel on slasher movies. And one of the panelists, basically, when it was her turn to talk about slasher movies, just sort of went off on why slasher movies were so terrible and evil and racist and sexist. okay, I mean, maybe that's a defendable position. But then she went on to, and if you enjoy them, you are also racist and sexist. So I was like, wait a minute, you're calling out the whole panel. They're there because they love these things. The audience is there because they love these things. They could be somewhere else. It's a convention, for God's sake. There's a lot of stuff going on. You're just attacking everyone there. Well, I mean, you know, I think she got what she wanted, which was attention, but just seems like a bizarre thing to do. You know, one thing you notice when you do these podcasts and you get some feedback, every film, no matter how terrible by my standards, is someone's favorite film. If they saw it at the right time with the right people in the right frame of mind, who knows what they were going through in their lives. And this thing reached out and touched them, and it brings back memories. It means something to them. So, you know, yeah, I'm not going to say a movie's good if I think it's bad, but there's nothing sillier on earth than arguing on the internet whether something is good or not. I'm just agog when I see people screaming at each other on whether or not, you know, the Star Wars movie was a good one or not.
Yeah,
you're both right. This person didn't like it. I mean, if you don't like it for bad reasons, okay, that says something about you. I don't like this Star Wars movie because it's got black stormtroopers. Okay, that's a pretty bad reason to dislike a movie. But then again, I see some folks who are like, the black stormtroopers were the best thing in the movie. It's like, well, that's not a very good reason to like a movie either. That's the best thing it's got going for it. So, but you know, whatever, just toxic fandom. I think it gets overrated. I mean, we always had this. When I was a kid, it was DC versus Marvel. Which was better? And the obvious answer was Marvel. I don't know what they were thinking, DC versus Marvel. Give me a break. But folks were very impassioned about it and still are to this day. And I still see some of it. And I'm like, you're probably about 62 years old, but you are spending way too much time on Twitter laughing every time a DC movie tanks. It's like nothing. Your life is not made better because this movie did not bring in the crowds. But that's it. Humans are very tribal.
Yeah.
And if we're not in some easily identifiable tribe, we create one.
No, but my dad always said there's two types of people in this world, those that put people in categories and those that don't.
That's right. Wise words right there.
And, you know, it's only gotten worse and worse, and people just like, you know, whatever. But
so far people have learned that I love Ray Harryhausen, and that's about all the information I've shared.
Well, we know what you were doing during the pandemic. You still went out there and you pulled off a film, Millennium Bug.
Okay, so that was cool. So the story of my filmmaking life is that I'm a high school science teacher, and I would constantly use zombies in my examples of science for some reason, because I love zombie films. And one day one of my students said, hey, my best friend's mom is making a zombie movie here in Sanford. You should give her a call. And I was like, what? Because when I was a kid, I did Super 8 and stuff, like I said, but I never really found a crew that was as into it as I was. And also Super 8 is a tough medium to work with. And then once you have your film, what do? You show it to your friends. That was about it. You know, there were no film festivals that were easy to get to. And every time you showed a Super 8 film, you destroyed it. Every time you showed it, it was starting to get more and more lines. It would break apart. It was a fascinating art form, very temporary. So, you know, that part of filmmaking kind of just faded away from my life, although I was still interested in special effects and makeup effects. So I called up Christine Parker, who'd be a good person to interview too. She's a great person. And yeah, she was making this film. I think she was a little alarmed at this nut out of the blue calling her up and everything. And I showed up. They were making a short zombie film. And we made this. It was Second Death. And we had so much fun doing it. So much fun that we said, let's expand this into a... because this film, this short film, was about a bunch of people stuck in a house surrounded by zombies and they all die. We broke some real ground there. And then we said, well, how did these people get in the house? Let's do a movie that tells the story, and this will be the ending. And so we did that, and we had a great time. And so, I mean, so really our first project was a short, and our second project was a feature film. That is nuts. That is absolutely insane, and I do not recommend that, but that's what we did. And not just a second film, a zombie apocalypse film. So you got to get a lot of people. This has always been something we did. You know, fast forward years later, we've done five feature films, and probably 24 shorts or so. I mean, an awful lot of stuff. And then we were planning the next stage, which is that Christine Parker, who is the director for most of these, almost all of them really, was kind of taking a step back and trying to get some other women to kind of step up and direct some films too. So I wrote a bunch of scripts, and several of them, I think three or four of them, were going to be used. We had different women that we'd worked with in the past in different capacities, Angela Giddings, Sierra Ayers, just a bunch of cool people were going to do these. And then COVID hit. We were just about to start the GoFundMe for this. And COVID hit, and it wiped everything out. You know, it was years. It was more than a year before people even started wading back in, trying to make films under the restrictions and everything. It was just very difficult. And people, I think it's easy to forget now just how scared everyone was. We didn't really know what the fatality rate was. What, you know, there was so more unknown than known. But the 48-hour film festival, and if anyone's trying to get into film, check and see if you have a 48-hour film festival in your area or anywhere near you. You go there on a Friday, you get a prompt, a name of a character, a prop that has to be in your film, and you get your genre, action, comedy, horror, silent musical, whatever. And then you've got 48 hours to write it, film it, edit it, render it out, and get it back to them. From 5 o'clock on a Friday to 5 o'clock on a Sunday. That's not easy. Now, Friday night, you write it. Saturday morning, crack of dawn, you start filming it. Probably want to finish. Saturday night, some poor slob is editing this thing together and hitting the render button and praying that when they wake up, it's almost rendered. That can be a big problem. And then literally you get there on 5 o'clock on Sunday and people are running in there with their computer still rendering. It's like 1 second left to go, 99% there. Somehow 99 to 100% takes the longest time. It's not going to be the best film you could make, but it's going to be a good, you know, the best film you can make in 48 hours. They started doing some of those with COVID, with the rules being that, you know, obviously we cannot all get together. So you had to write and do all this with people shooting their own footage at home. And you know, so it was, again, one of those things where since we couldn't do what we normally would do, we had to get creative. What story can you tell where everything is basically shot individually? You know, some people did the obvious, do a Zoom meeting movie. You know, but you got to keep in mind, everyone's going to do that. So if there's a way of breaking through that, you know, we did a few different things. And, Millennium Bug was the idea that these people in 1999 hid because, of course, the world was going to end because of Y2K. They buried themselves in their basements and everything. And now, 20 years later, they come out, and they come out in the middle of the pandemic. So, which proves to them that they were right, that there was going to be a catastrophe. They think because all the streets are abandoned and there's nobody outside, that they were right. Y2K was the end of the world. And so we had some fun with it. Having fun with a global pandemic, that's our motto. Take lemons and make lemonade out of it. But it was a lot of fun. I think we did three of those COVID pandemic 48-hour films, and it was fun to make them. It was fun to be doing something creative again. Desperately needed that. And there were some folks I hadn't seen in years. There's still some people I have yet to see from before the pandemic. And now that the conventions are starting to happen again, I'm very hopeful that I'll see them. I didn't lose anyone in my, is that true or not? Off the top of my head, I'm not aware of anyone that we lost to COVID. But there are a few people who, because of their health issues, are probably still avoiding conventions and things. And, you know, that's rough. That's rough because, you know, our people, our tribe, the nerds, the geeks, the Star Trek fans, the Marvel versus DC people, a lot of them, I'm lucky. I have a, you know, good job, a good marriage and everything else. Some folks, you know, they live on these things. It's the conventions are what keep them going. They hate their job. They're not happy with their life. There's a lot of things that are, you know, but they have this convention where they get to see people. They're loved, they're supported. It's an affirmation kind of thing. And even those of us where things are going pretty well, it's still great to see folks and get that human connection that we're losing. We're losing so much of that. Theaters are dying. People would rather do things at home, and I understand why, but there's something, we're social animals. And letting that slip away is gonna cost us. And we're already starting to see the cost. Just come to a high school and watch the kids, talk to the kids, and you'll see the cost.
Yeah, my wife is a high school teacher, now the school librarian, and I used to work at a college campus as a police officer. So I used to see, you know, before the pandemic, so I know the dynamics, and I talk to guys that are still there, and the dynamics change. But going back to Millennium Bug, what I loved about it was the tongue-in-cheek humor with it, where the reason they came out of their cubby holes, and it was almost like a reverse, like zombies coming out of the grave type thing, is because they ran out of toilet paper. And one guy's like, we need more toilet paper. And of course, that was the big, you know, this is something that you talk about, you know, things age, you haven't hit that right time. I still think people remember about the toilet paper shortage, you know, where everybody, it was like gold. Now it's what, eggs and certain other, whatever. It always seems to rotate to what the new gold commodity is.
Yeah. I think people learn from this, and it's a good lesson to learn. Civilization is a well-stacked house of cards. But like any house of cards, it doesn't take a whole lot of disruption for things to start going wrong. And yeah, there is no commodity out there, toilet paper or what, that can survive everybody deciding at once that they need it. Everybody goes out. There isn't a village supply of toilet paper. There's enough to supply the normal number of people who buy it. Everybody goes out and gets gas on the same day they run out of gas. So yeah, that was a funny bit. That wrote itself. Angela Giddings and I wrote that. And it was just one of those things, you just get together with your friends. And this is really the best way to write a screenplay for a short, something like this, especially something where you're under the gun. We go out to dinner. Our tradition's always been we go out to a Mexican restaurant and we just throw ideas around. You know, you get a title and the title brings some ideas. And then one person, and with a lot of these, it would usually be Christine, would go home and bang out a screenplay and we would know what to do. Millennium Bug was fun. And just some of the slapstick, you know, we filmed it sort of in the style of a silent movie. That was fun. Paul was great. My favorite bit was where the woman comes out after 20 years and she's surrounded by cats. And she's like that, oh, my cats are still here. My kitties, it's a miracle. And the guy's like, yeah, I'm pretty sure that's not the same cats. And she's like screaming. I'm like, okay, whatever. Yeah.
And you were that guy.
Or my cat. Yeah, I was that guy. I'm the one who also opened the fridge and then goes staggering backwards because apparently it hasn't been open in 20 years and things have gone bad. That was fun. We did that. We did a trailer where we mashed up Apocalypse Now and The Hobbit, or Lord of the Rings and Apocalypse Now, Lord of the Apocalypse or something. And there was another one I can't remember, but those 48-hour things are great things if you want to break into indie film. Because if you go there, first of all, if you have any skill, people will be fighting over you. You just go there. It's like, I can do makeup. And there'll be people like tackling each other to try to get to you. But they're almost always looking for cast members, you know, just folks who want to hold the microphone, hold the boom mic. It's fun to get on the set. And you need to get on the set to see if this is what you want to do. Because one thing that I noticed, and you got to be careful of this. Some folks, once they make, well, you start shooting, it gets in their blood, it gets bit bad. And I wasn't, you know, I go back to prepare for this and I went back and looked at my IMDb page. And I'm always astonished when I look at the numbers that they have there. I'm like, okay, that's got to be wrong. I have not worked on that many projects. But then I call them up and I'm like, oh yeah. I helped on this weekend. I did this. I used to laugh at people when they were interviewing film folks. And they're like, I don't even remember that film. And I don't, you know, I was like, they're just pretending they don't remember these projects that they worked on. And I take it all back. I totally understand now. After a while, you know, it's just what I do. I help folks out on the weekends. I'll do some makeup and I don't even think about it again. It adds up. Some people like me, it gets in your blood. You can't imagine not doing it. And then some folks, it's just a bucket list thing. I want to be in a movie. I want to play a zombie in a movie. And then having done it, they're like, okay, that was fun. And they move on. So you got to be careful if you're one of the people who gets bit hard, make sure that the folks that you're now signing up for your next project actually want to keep doing this. because to be on a film set's a lot of hurry up and wait. It's mostly you just sitting around waiting for your thing to do. Unless you're the cameraman or something, you're probably not needed 24/7, but you got to be there. And some folks, that's not a whole lot of fun. If you're like a social butterfly like me, where I can just be on the set and just yap up at people and just talk, and you know, that's to me a better way of spending a day than most ways of spending a day. That's fine. But for some folks, it gets old fast. Find out what kind of person you are and what kind of person the folks you're depending on are. And if you can't find anyone else who wants to do it, look into animation.
Yeah.
The one thing you can still do on your own. And boy, there are programs that are making that so much easier too. Like, you don't even have to draw all that well. That used to be a kind of a requirement to be an animator. And now if you've got the patience and, you know, learn how to do filmmaking, learn how to tell a story, and increasingly the art can be taken care of. Now, again, that's not going to be as good as if you really could draw yourself and put your personal print on things. But if you're just trying to tell a story, that's fine. You know, not everyone has to be as good at all things. But one thing you may not be the best artist. You may not have a red camera. You may not have all these advantages that you can think of. But if you're a good storyteller, you have a greater advantage than anyone who has those things, because that's really the currency of filmmaking. It's telling a story, and a good storyteller, no matter what they're doing, no matter what medium they're using, people will appreciate it. You'll win awards. You'll get recognition.
Now, you sent me links to a lot of different shorts and stuff like that were on YouTube that you participated in, either acting, directing, writing, special effects, whatever. And, of course, Millennium Bug was one of them. Sticking with the more comedic take, The Mummy, Sweeted version.
Yeah. Well, that was fun. So we decided we were going to make a mummy movie. And this one you can actually, I think it's on Amazon Prime, Blood of the Mummy. And that's our best movie in terms of technical, acting, music. I mean, it's got lots of good stuff. I think it stands up to movies that cost a lot more. And that would be almost every other movie you'll ever see. But before that, just for fun, we decided to do the Sweeted Mummy thing. And this, I don't know, there was a film called Be Kind, Rewind. And if I remember the premise right, a guy runs a video store and somehow all the videos get trashed or something. So he and his buddies just make new versions of old films and claims that they're from Sweden. My poor wife must have been taking a nap there. She got it. These films are technically completely incompetent, just filmed with his friends, and they claim they're from Sweden. So they're Sweeted. And we decided to do that for Hammer's version of The Mummy, which is one of my favorites. I'm a huge Hammer fan. Probably my favorite group. If you say you can only take one group of films with you to the desert island that somehow has electricity and a TV and a VCR, it would be Hammer. Just give me all the Hammer films. I'll just live the rest of my life watching them over and over again. And I love The Mummy. It's got Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee, just amazing production values. Terrence Fisher, one of the best directors ever. And we decided to make our version of that. That was a lot of fun. Because, and I hope that the comedy comes across, we weren't making fun of The Mummy. We were having fun with the film. To do something like that and to do it well, I think you have to love what it is. I love that movie, The Mummy. And because I love it, I think I can parody it. I feel like I have, you know, I can do that because I'm not mocking it. It's not a movie to be made fun of. We're having fun with it, you know, taking scenes and pushing them to their limit. And, you know, it was fun.
And we found it during that movie.
People appreciate it.
I appreciate it. And we also find it during the movie. You have one of those faces that people just have.
I have one of those faces. Yeah, because we keep playing. We only had so many people and we had way more roles. So we play multiple roles in the movie. It's like, hey, you look like, I got one of those faces. That's fun. Yeah, and that's the sort of thing. Listen, if that's the kind of movie you want to make, you just want to get together with your friends, kids especially, just want to get together with your friends and make some goofball parodies. on the level of, say, old Mad Magazine parodies of a successful film, go right ahead. That's a perfectly good way to spend your time. I tell parents, your kid's lonely, your kid doesn't have any friends, get him a movie camera and let him make movies. Kid's always talking about movies. He's sketching doodles in his notebook and everything. He's got, tells me these endless stories of his characters and what they do. A lot of people are good at building worlds without ever getting to a story in the world, but that's whatever. Yeah, just get together with your friends and make a movie. It's like in the old days, you get together with your friends and make a band, mm-hmm. and you'd practice, and you sounded terrible, but you were going to be the next Ramones, Rolling Stones, whatever, it depends on your age. And that never happened. But you know what? Okay, so did you waste your time? No, you spent your time with your friends making art, getting better at it. Okay, so it never became your career. Well, so what? You were in a rock band. You played at, you know, some local things and everything. You had fun. You did, you created something. Creating is something all humans should do. Thank some you. People are blessed, born with artistic talent. I'm not one of them. My sisters can draw. My sisters can sculpt. My sisters can do all kinds of things. You know, I can't do that. So I had to find something else. And in photography, I discovered, you know, ways that I could take something and maybe make it more beautiful or make it interesting and feel good about it. And then with the benefit of years going by and doing a lot of writing, mostly nonfiction, I've learned enough about writing that hopefully I can now explore that part of creativity. If I can go to bed every night and I've done something, it doesn't have to be a lot, doesn't have to be a whole lot, but I've done something. There's something that exists now that did not exist this morning, and it only exists because I exist. I feel good about my life. I feel good about things, and I can sleep well. I understand. I understand the despair people have when they feel like their life is going by and nothing's changing and they're not where they thought they would be. And, you know, I don't have all the answers. If I did, I'd write books about it and make millions of dollars. But I think one thing definitely to explore is find some creative outlet and ignore any of those voices in your head that are telling you this is meaningless. You're painting by numbers. So paint by numbers. Find it. There's lots of things out there. Explore. My wife does these beautiful diamond paintings that are, you know, it's a group of people. You wouldn't even know that these people exist. You find some art form and you think, I'm the only person in the world that's doing this with popsicle sticks. And then you find out, oh, no, there's a Facebook group devoted to it. They have their own magazine, and it's a big industry. $1 billion every year spent on popsicle art. You'll find a culture. You'll find a group of like-minded people. But, you know, take that step. Explore your creativity. And don't tell me you're not creative. Everyone's creative. It's part of our genetics. You just need to find the thing that you enjoy doing that makes you happy doing it.
Exactly.
Find it and don't let anyone tell you not to.
And speaking of writing, I know this next story we're going to talk about, you're going to turn into a novel or a series of novels. And I love the title. Because you're 400 Ways to Kill a Vampire. And the reason I love it is I can see with the backstory, and I'm sure these are movies you've probably seen before, where you see Captain Kronos, vampire hunter, and they had to figure out which way this vampire, what type of vampire this is, and how it can be destroyed. I'm also remembered of The Cave of the Living Dead, which was a European movie, where, again, the vampires have a different kind of history type thing, different kind of mythos. And everybody always thinks all vampires are like this or like that. But it's just,
right.
I love it when they take it because there's 400 ways. And I'm thinking the books that you're probably going to write with this, there's going to be these different types of vampires and there's going to be different ways mm-hmm. to off them and that kind of stuff. But talk about the book idea and the short.
This short came about because of my good friend, Jerry Chandler, who is, if you listen to the Decades of Horror, writes these really long, but really smart, notes about our films and stuff. He's a really cool guy. He's a policeman in Virginia, a even bigger movie nerd than I am. And he and I would have this friendly rivalry, you know, argument about vampires. Because I think vampires are probably the coolest monster, you know, better than zombies. Although all I ever make are zombie movies usually. They're just easier to make. But I'll always make fun of vampires because you know, everything kills them. And they're so arrogant. They're such arrogant dicks about it, too. You know, like, I am immortal. I was old when you were but us. Blah, blah, blah. It's like, yeah, I could kill you with a garlic pizza. There's so many things that kill you. But they're bragging about, well, I can do this. I can do that. It's like, yeah, I can walk out in the sunlight.
I can get a tan.
Try that. Everything. I can get a tan. I throw a silver dime at you, and it sinks into your head. You're plucking it out. You're screaming as you dig at your moldy flesh. Shut up. So I wrote the script from the point of view of the vampire hunter, because I was always more of a fan of Van Helsing than Dracula. I've never kind of got the, you know, oh, Dracula, he's so dreamy. He's a freaking parasite. The only vampire that I like the fact that we are given to be empathetic. Oh, sympathetic is the right word, but empathetic to the vampire is Let the Right One In, which is one of my favorite movies. Brilliant. And they do something that a lot of filmmakers just can't seem to figure out how to do. Ellie is a monster, 100% a monster. But we understand. We do get, this is what she does to survive. But to me, it was also a very sad story, because this little boy gets dragged into this too. And you realize by the end of the movie, he's basically going to be the old guy that's in the movie and taking care of her. You know, I thought that was just a marvelous film. But I wanted to tell it from the point of view of the vampire hunter. And being a vampire hunter, after a while, like anything else, it's just a job. It's you know, you're tired of it. This is what you do. You get up and you go. If I killed a vampire, it would be the high point of my life. But if my job was killing vampires, it's just, you know, I went out, you know, I cleaned a septic tank. I rid a house of roaches. I killed a vampire. And so, you know, to kind of get this philosophy on there, the whole premise was he captures this vampire. He's got him strapped to a hawthorn tree, which is how they killed Dracula in the Satanic Rites of Dracula. It's the bush that they made the crown of thorns for Christ from. And yet one more thing that can kill vampires. So a vampire could be walking through the woods, minding his own business, and suddenly stumble into this tree, and it's slicing him open. He's bleeding uncontrollably. It's like, oh, another thing that kills me. I was unaware that this also will kill me. And then we bring in some other stuff happens. But the crux of the film was basically these two characters, the vampire that's immobilized, yelling about what's going to happen to this guy, and the vampire hunter just basically, you know, making fun of him. And I just enjoyed that dynamic. And other stuff happens. People, I think it still is on YouTube somewhere. So if you get a chance, I really enjoyed it. I loved writing it. And we got a lot of, and I acted in it too, because, just because. Now, did I write that thinking I would play that character? Yes. Yes, I did. And as an actor, I have a very limited range. And then people, when I say this, some of the people I work with are like, oh no, Bill, you're fantastic. And it's like, okay, again, look at how many times when I've acted, it's been something I wrote. I am not writing a role for me that requires like Michael Ray Williams, who played the vampire in 400 Ways to Play a Vampire. He's an actor. He's a really good actor. If you're looking for a good actor, Michael Ray Williams, I will not steer you wrong. I've seen him do, I saw him do a one-man play where he played about 20 or 30 characters and pulled it off, where you actually could figure out who the characters were just from body motion and stuff. Really, really good. He's a great actor. I am not a great actor, but I can play certain characters pretty well, especially if they're characters I wrote, because I have a better chance of memorizing the dialogue, which I'm not particularly good at. Even if I wrote the dialogue, it's embarrassing. So that was fun playing that character. And yeah, and then I started thinking, I enjoyed that so much that this is where, you know, I was like, I'm going to turn this into a feature length film. And I wrote a script. And it was really, really good. It was a little too long. And then so I had to cut stuff out. And cutting stuff out was like, so then I was like, wait a minute. Whoa, what if I make this a mini series? I mean, yeah, we could say a series of films, but this is where the realistic part of my brain starts going. It's like, no one's going to want to spend the next 5 or 10 years of their life making these films. You know, you want to assume every film is one and done, because you never know if there's going to be a next one. So I said, I'll make a series of short, you know, like 40-minute series. People were starting to do web series and YouTube series and stuff. And then that went on. And now it's like I've got about 250 minutes of screenplay here. And at some point I just woke up and like, this is not going to happen. This is even more unrealistic than making the two films. It's just as long. It's going to take just as much work. And now I'm talking literally, we're talking, listen, everyone, the next 6 years of your life is going to be doing my project. And it's like, heartbreaking. So I started, and then I said, you know, I've got the dialogue. I've got the story. I've got the characters. I have everything except like description and narrative. I'll turn it into a novel. So I did that. That took a while. And it's still there. It's still there, and I need to go back to it and cut it up. It ended up being a really long novel. And this is, again, I like to think of myself as a realistic person. I don't want to be deluded. A lot of creative people, they're dreamers, and their dreams can get in the way of their dreams. You know, if you're not a published writer, and you write the next Lord of the Rings, you've built a world that makes J.R.R. Tolkien look like Dick, Jane, and Sally. You've got this huge thing. Your first book is a 500-page tome that is just, you know, it is never going to get published. Because if a publisher sees an unknown writer, someone who has absolutely no name at all, and this thing gets dumped in their lap, I doubt it's even going to get opened, because this has happened to them before, and it's been a tremendous waste of their time. And they're probably right, because it's unrealistic. And if you are an unrealistic person, publishers don't want to work with you. You're going to have to be edited. And if you're that unrealistic, you're not going to want to be edited and things. You've just given them a reason to ignore you. And would a reader, how many readers are there going to be for this unknown writer who's just dropped this massive thing there? It just looks intimidating. So I was like, okay, I'll get back to this another time. I'm still glad I wrote it, because I learned a lot writing it. When COVID hit, I had another project that I was working on, a feature film called Realm, about a lawyer who accidentally summons a demon and tries to use the demon to advance his ambitions. And the demon is unhappy with this prospect here. And so you have this argument between these two characters. And I wrote it to be a low-budget movie. A lot of it takes place in the basement, where this creature is being held basically hostage by this guy. So not a huge cast, not a whole lot of sets. And something that's easy to explain. Tell people, a lawyer summons a demon. All right. They're like, oh, okay. And I described this idea to some people at a convention, some real writers, who I wish I'd written down their names, because they really encouraged me to pursue it. And they were like, yeah, I'd read that book. That's all it took, just a little bit. So I wrote the screenplay, and then COVID hit, and I'm like, well, this isn't going to happen. And a lot of times with films, once momentum gets lost, it doesn't come back. This is true in Hollywood too. There's projects that, you know, everything was going good for them and something went wrong, and it feels like, okay, so the lead actor OD'd, put in a different actor. And it's like, nah. People seem to feel like, oh, I got an unlucky look feeling or something. Once it falls apart, it almost never comes back. So many good projects just died on the vine that way. And I didn't want this project to die on the vine. I really like the characters. I like the story. So I said, I'm going to do this again. I'm stuck at home. Nobody's making movies. I've got all this time. You know, how many of us said, if only I didn't have to go to work every day, if I could stay home and do stuff, I'm going to clean the house. I'm going to write a novel. I'm going to do this and this and this. And then we were handed this opportunity. And most people didn't do anything. And I'll bet there's a lot of depression over that too. Because now we're going back to work. It's like, what do we have to show for that little horrible vacation? But yeah, I went through this and I wrote it. It turns out it's actually not easy to write a novel. Even if you have the story and the dialogue and the characters and everything else laid out in front of you, that's just a skeleton. And you've got to put all the meat on it and skin and dressing and everything else. It's a lot of work. But I did it, and it worked out well, because right as I was finishing it up, my intention all along had been to go to some of these conventions where there'll be small publishers who have pitch sessions. And they say, if you have a book finished, you know, pitch it to us. And if we like your pitch, we'll ask you to send us the first three chapters. And specifically, I wanted to do this for Falstaff Books, which is a publishing house out of Charlotte. It's run by John Hartness, who's a really good writer. I have friends who have published books with them. I mean, I called them the cool kids table. It's like all the cool kids had a book for Falstaff. It's like, I want to be one of the cool kids. So that was my intention to pitch it. Of course, the conventions died too. So there were no pitch sessions, but I'm like, I'm still plugging along. It's like, I'm either going to die of this disease or it's going to go away and things will get back to normal. And then just as I was getting near finishing it, Falstaff did something they don't do very often, which is they said, the month of February, we are going to accept unsolicited submissions. See, if you have a book done and you send it to Tor or Random House, it goes straight into the trash. It is not going to get looked at all. It just isn't going to happen. But if one of them says, okay, the month of February, we will actually look at it. We're not promising you anything. We may take none of them, but it will be looked at. Okay, so that was it. I finished up as fast as I could, and I sent it out. I also had, and I freely admit this, I had the advantage that the person who'd be looking at it was a friend of mine. And that meant to me, I know what that meant. It meant that it would actually get read, maybe longer than it would deserve to get read before they rejected it, if they were going to reject it. It was definitely not going to mean that they would publish it, because they're not going to do that. They may like you. There's a lot of people they like, but they will only publish something they think will make money. This is not a charity. So your book has to be good. Just because you have friends, the best thing your friends can do is give you an opportunity.
Yeah.
But whether you succeed or not is going to depend on the material. And thank goodness they liked it enough that it got accepted and went through the editing process. Boy, there's a lot more to publishing a book than anyone who hasn't published a book knows. That's just the first step. Being accepted, that's the exciting step. Yay. But then it goes to an editor who is the most careful reader you will ever have, and you had best listen to what they tell you. I was lucky enough to have Alexander Christian and Melissa McCarthy. Melissa Gilbert. And these are really nice, nurturing people who are willing to work with a first-time writer and gently say, I wasn't clear on this. Where were you going here? And if you have a brain in your head, you listen to your editor. You do not argue with them. This is the most careful reader you will ever have. Your mom is not going to read your book as carefully as your editor does. If they're confused about something, fix it. Because the average person is not going to be reading it as carefully as your editor. They're going to be way confused. And again, confusing a reader is like doing that thing in film where you take them out. Reading, I think, is another kind of hypnosis. And things like typos take you right out. Things like, you know, you're not clear on who's speaking take you right out. There's a lot of things to avoid. It's going to be, so the latest word is ROM will have its roll out at RavenCon in April. I believe it's April 21st to the 23rd in Roanoke, Virginia, which is totally appropriate because the demon in this novel is a raven demon. So RavenCon is the perfect place, but that was completely unintentional. And that's where it's going to have its rollout. I've seen the cover. Very exciting. Beautiful. My wife's going to make a diamond painting out of that cover. And this will be my first published book, but hopefully not my last one. I've already finished the sequel. I'm polishing it up right now before I send it out. Hopefully it will also be enjoyable enough to be published. And I can see me doing this. I can see this being kind of like the next, and I, you know, let's face it, get on in years, last stage of my artistic endeavors is to do writing. I love film. I love film, but as we saw, film has one serious flaw. It is a communal thing. It requires a lot of people. And it's never easy to get those people together, and outside events completely beyond your control can destroy that ability to do that. Whereas writing novels is something you can do. Just all you need is yourself and your typewriter or word processor or computer or something. So it's all on you, for better or ill. It's all on you. Well,
congratulations.
I've got a lot of ideas.
Congratulations. Thank you. On the Thank thing you. Coming out. But there's two other shorts I want to talk about before I get to the one main feature I was able to watch. And both of these shorts reminded me of good Tales from the Dark Side episodes.
You know, thank you. That's a compliment.
I think of, you know, because, you know, 20 minutes, it does a premise, you go through, and it gave that vibe to me, like a modern version of that. And Catch Me If You Can. I thought it was appropriate Tales from the Dark Side.
That's people say, how many have you directed? And that's a little confusing because some of the shorts that we do are really one day affairs. And I think my name is on as director, but I see them almost as communal kind of thing. You know, on an indie set, the whole thing of who's the director, who's the cinematographer, who's this and who's that is a little loosey-goosey. It can be. It doesn't have to be. And if there is a definite director, like when Christine's directing, Christine's the director. She's much more patient than a lot of directors are about accepting suggestions and things. But you need to get the lay of the land. Be real careful about staying in your lane. Some people don't appreciate it if you're making suggestions. And then some people make suggestions in a way that doesn't sound like suggestions. It sounds like they think the director. And that is definitely not going to endear you to anyone on the set, especially the director. But Catch Me If You Can is the one I can just, you know, say, yeah, I wrote and directed this. This was my, you know, big chance to do it. And I was so fortunate that I had good actors. Robert and especially Emily Vassilos, who's one of my best friends. Now, at the time, you know, she was someone we had worked with on a film that I really liked working with. We worked on A Few Brains More. And she's just a lovely person and a really good actress. And so my brother-in-law was into geocaching, which is, you know, people bury stuff somewhere and you use your GPS to find it and dig it up and get a little reward or something and you bury it back there or maybe with something else. And the way my diseased brain works is as soon as I heard of this, the first thing I thought of was, wow, that sounds like a really easy way for a serial killer to get people. Just tell them that there's something here. And when they show up for the buried treasure, he hits them in the head with a pickaxe or something. That's literally every time I hear something new, my brain usually goes to, this would be a great way to fight zombies, or this would be a wonderful way for serial killers to take us out. Those are usually the two extremes, good or bad. And so I had this with this young couple, a lovely young couple. And she's really into geocaching. So they do this. And every time they find something, they got to solve these silly clues that are like something out of a Batman thing, but she's really good at it. Every time they find something, the stakes are getting higher and higher. There's like actual cash in here or a valuable coin or a gold watch or all kinds of really good stuff. And it's getting late and they really need to be heading back home, but they're just, you know, they're finding all this cool stuff. So they just keep getting led further and further into the woods, into the mysterious cabin. And I don't think I'm giving anything away to say it doesn't end well. And that was one of the things, besides having some fun with geocaching, the other thing I wanted to do is I really like those characters. I like that young couple. And they were played by actors who I also actually like in real life a great deal. That's how horror should be. Mm-hmm. If a horror movie should have horrible things happening to good people. One of the reasons I don't like slasher movies is that I don't like most of the people in slasher movies. They're unlikable. People would complain, oh my God, it's so sick. People cheer when Jason shows up. Why shouldn't we cheer? We've just spent 20 minutes with these awful adolescents who are uninteresting and deserve to die. Well, no, they don't deserve to die. But frankly, when they do die, it's the most interesting part of the movie. It's the only thing that wakes me up. No, I like it. That's one of the reasons why I think the Scream movies work better. These are actually some interesting, likable characters. And then bad things happen to them. And you feel bad. Oh no, I hope she gets away, even though you know the middle of the movie, she ain't getting away. Come on. She's totally out. But you know, do that. So yes, I was happy with how that turned out. It was a difficult, there were some difficulties in that shoot. That wasn't the one where a flying squirrel almost knocked me out of a tree though. Let me think about that. No, there was, I was up in a tree. Okay. We don't have cranes and we didn't have, drones or anything at the time. If we wanted a shot down, someone had to get on a ladder and ladders only go so high. Trees on the other hand can go much higher. So I was up in a tree on a ladder, big ladder. And I feel something jump on my back, run up my neck, get on my head and jump off. And then I see a flying squirrel just zipping down there. I nearly fell out of the tree, which would have been bad because I was holding the camera.
I think it's more bad as you, you know.
I'm always very nervous about losing. There was a shot in, I think it was Catch Me If You Can, where on the way back it was so dark and we were filming in the outskirts of Raleigh. I mean, the woods. and I stepped into a stump hole and fell, and people heard me going down because I'm sure I was shrieking. And I hit the ground, but I was like, the first words out of my mouth is, the camera's okay. I'd fallen and managed to save the camera. I was holding it up like Son of Kong here. If the camera breaks, we're well and truly screwed there. But that was a fun shoot, but mostly because I really, really enjoyed working with that crew and those actors. There's only two people. There is a shot at the end with Shane and a few of the others. All these people that show up in our films are basically our friends.
Yeah.
And you find out after shooting with them a few times who can act and who can't act. And if they can't act, that doesn't mean you don't use them anymore. You just write roles that fits their personality. And then it's fine. So yeah, watching these things does really give me it gives you a little sense of nostalgia. You know, that's the other good thing about shooting films is that there's a preserved evidence of what you did. I love actors who do theater, and they're so good at it and everything. A lot of the good actors that we've worked with, people like Michael and Emily, have done theater. But boy, I would have a hard time doing that when you put all this work in and then you perform it a few times and then it's over and you have nothing to, there's no proof that you did this other than the memories of the people who watched it. And there's kind of a beautiful poetry in that this performance, this art only exists now as memories. I admire that. But I don't like it. I would rather have something where I can take out my grandkids and, share, this is what grandpa did. It's like, oh God, he's going to make us watch these movies again. There's something there to show for all your hard work. And I'm glad that we have that.
What I liked about it was the way they were written and the way they acted. You actually, like you said, you started to care about the two characters, and you're learning more about them. And yeah, for anybody that's watched horror films or psychological thrillers, whatever you want to call it, you know where it's going to lead, and especially when you get to where it gets dark and where they show up at the cabin in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
You know where it's going, and it's not no shocker at all. But the thing is, as we said earlier, just because it hit your expectations still doesn't mean it's not good. You enjoy it. You had that satisfying conclusion. I knew you're going to see more people show up because it was already implied that she's like, oh, nobody's ever solved this one. It's been out there for a while. And he's like, oh man, you got all this great stuff. And then I knew when he mentioned about his watch, like she was like, oh, put your watch in here. He goes, no, this watch is like $500 or something. I knew when those guys were going through, oh, there's the watch. And I was like,
there's the watch.
Yeah. The next little nugget to keep them going through, cause their greed gets the better of them. And I think this had to have happened after your flying squirrel incident, because that was a line of dialogue he said when he was in a tree. It's like, oh, I don't want a flying squirrel to make me fall out of the tree.
You're absolutely right. So that was the flying squirrel would have been shooting our first feature length movie, Forever Dead. Yes, that would have been in the woods behind Christine's house. It all blends together. The only thing that changes when I'm looking at these films is me. It's like, oh my gosh. I used to actually have like a beard that had the same color as my hair, and I had more hair. So yeah, that is the one bad thing about film. It's a terrifying chronicle of your decline.
Well, it depends which way you want to look at it. It's not your decline. It's just the current your state of at that moment. And going back to live theater.
That's very sweet. That's a very sweet way of saying decline. Yeah. But no.
Well, you and I are in the same area, so I'm not going to go that. I'm not going to go that route. You're not going to force me down that path. But when I interviewed Elizabeth Shepherd years ago, and of course she's done awesome theater work, and we were talking about her theater work, and I'll never forget what she said. Each night's performance is tailor made to that night's audience, and which is true, and that's the beauty of live theater is. Each night you're learning and doing something different, and the audience, their reactions are different. And that's the main, I know you're looking at it, and I agree with you a lot, where it's nice to have things preserved, but even if you film a live theater performance, you're not in that audience and getting the feel and the vibe that the actors are getting and that those other audience members are getting. So you have that detached sense feeling. But what you do get in watching a movie, especially if it's at a theater, you still get the shared experience of enjoying it with that audience. And if that audience is really into it, then you're going to be into it. And sometimes it can make a movie a lot better than it has right to be. Or on the other hand, it could make it worse if they're not reacting the way you cope.
If everyone's groaning. I think one of the best experiences I ever had in my life, film watching life, movie going life, was the opening night of Blair Witch Project. Because I was with a hot crowd, the place was packed, and I'd say at least half the people had bought the hype that this was a legit movie, this was found footage that they had actually found.
A documentary,
yes. And the tension at the end, as she's going down the stairs, you know, when we get to the last few moments of the film, I've never felt so much tension in a theater before, where people were starting to rise out of their chairs like they were about to bolt for the exit. I've never seen that. And then it ended and the screen goes black and then everyone started laughing because, you know, the tension had been released and we suddenly, you know, we're looking at each other like this is kind of silly, but that was great. That was just so wonderful. Now you watch it on TV and you get none of that. You get none of that at all. You can still admire the film for what it is. And it certainly helped usher in a whole new genre. It wasn't the first found footage. Cannibal Holocaust should probably take that credit. But it's the one that really turned it into a new way of making films that people were aware of. But yeah, there is that communal thing. And again, I hate that we're losing it. The only movies that people go to see at theaters these days are Marvel movies, big budget superhero movies, and low budget horror movies. So I'm glad horror is still there, but I'm not sure that those two things are enough to keep this industry going.
Everything Everywhere All at Once made over 100 million, and that was amazing.
That was a marvelous exception to the rule. You're absolutely right. When I heard about it, I'm like, well, this is a little art film that no one's going to go see. And then I kept hearing people were liking it, and finally I went to see it. I'm like, yeah.
Oh.
But that is now that movie though. That's lightning in a bottle. That's not really a model for how people should be making movies, other than the fact it's really cleverly written, well acted. I mean, it's solid on everything.
Yes.
But you got to be, and this is why it's hard. It's easier to write a good novel than to make a great movie. I've said that, and people look at me like, how dare you? I'm like, how is that even debatable? It takes one person to write a great novel. It's not easy. I didn't say it was easy. I said it's easier than making a great movie. And I think there are more great novels than great movies. So I think I'm on solid ground here. But to make a great movie, you also need a great writer and a great cinematographer and good actors and this and that and a whole bunch of other things that have all got to come together. Yeah, the work is spread out among more people, but that also means there's a lot of potential for weak links. And one bad thing, imagine The Godfather with the original cast that they were talking about. Danny Thomas as Don Corleone. I don't think so. You know, there's so many things that can go wrong. Even if you have good people. Like I said, Harlan Ellison is my favorite writer. You can see Harlan Ellison's screenplay on a movie called The Oscar. And boy, it's terrible. But when you're watching it, I think to myself, would this dialogue, which is so dire in this movie, would it be so bad if it were being spoken by actors who could pull that off, that can take purple prose and make it Shakespearean? Because again, the dialogue of The Godfather, if it were the wrong actors, it would be laughable.
Yeah.
Laughable. It's so, it's very, you know, deliberate and over the top, but if you have the right people, sounds good. So, yeah, but thank you for your kind words on Catch Me If You Can. It won several awards and it got accepted at the Nevermore Film Festival, which in Durham, which is a big feather in my cap, I felt, because that's a great film festival. They had it just last week. I wasn't able to go, which is too bad because another really good filmmaker, Christopher Moore, had one of his films there and I would have loved to have supported him. There's a lot of good filmmakers, Jason Buterin, Christopher Moore, if I start naming them, then I'm going to get in trouble.
You're better off just keeping it generic. But the other movie I was talking about,
Go ahead.
The other movie I was talking about.
I was going to say North Carolina has been blessed with some good filmmakers.
Oh, trust me. I mean, just like my area, every area has good filmmakers. It's just a matter of being given them the chance to be recognized. Mm-hmm. Belladonna. was the other movie that you did, which is kind of like a Tales from the Dark Side type twist
to it.
Yeah,
I see that. that was, okay, so that was one. I wrote that screenplay for a friend of mine who I thought, you know, this would be a cool thing to, you know, she was maybe going through a rough time, and this would be a fun thing for her to work on. So it was kind of written for a friend, but she moved away and her life got really cool. She's doing very well, which I'm happy for, but then I didn't have the person. And I'm one of these people, it can be a mistake to write something where you're, especially a screenplay where you've got it in your head and you've got the people in your head and everything, because they may not be available. And then once you've lost that, with me at least, I have a hard time shifting gears and saying, okay, let's do someone else. So I kind of put that on the back burner. That was going to be like the second film I would direct, and it just didn't feel like something I wanted to do without her. And it was a very different film. It was a much more low budget. The creature, I don't know how much I want to give away, but the creature was not nearly as spectacular as she turned out in the final product. But another filmmaker, another really good filmmaker, Brett Mullen, mm-hmm. also a good person to interview. He's done a couple of feature films, and we worked with him on a few shorts. Amazing cinematographer, you know, kind of like learned his craft doing wedding cinematography. And boy, you have to get good when you're doing wedding cinematography, because there's no cut. Let's do it over. You got to get it right the first time, or you got some angry brides on you.
You don't want bridezillas, that's for sure. That's
ooh. No. But he knows. He's one of those people who knows how to shoot a shot. If you have just a simple, you know, we're going to shoot this person doing something and there's a fence, he knows where to put the camera so that there's composition going on. There's a million ways to do it. And he has that eye. He's got that poetic eye there. So he was asking, I've got this block of time where I don't have any projects going on. Do you have any scripts? I'm like, oh yeah, I got this one here. And I sent it to him and he made some suggestions, because originally it was about a succubus, which wouldn't require a whole lot of special effects and everything. And he came up with an idea for more of a Lamia, a snake woman. I'm like, okay, I'm not doing the makeup effects here. So sure. Yeah. Snake woman it is. And we kind of went in that direction, and it didn't take very long to come up with a script that he was happy with. And the next thing I know, like 2 weeks later, he's like, hey, come on out. We're shooting. And I went out there. They had found this amazing set. I mean, could you believe that house? This was like built during Civil War times. And it was then after the war, it was like a ladies club. So the weirdest combination, and then, you know, it had been upgraded during the years. It was the strangest combination of like 1920s Art Deco, Greek sculptures, a stained glass window at the top of a spiral staircase. I'm like, is this a Dario Argento film? This is beautiful. And when I'm there, I was almost drooling because I was thinking, this is gorgeous just to be here watching it. But when Brett is done filming it, it's going to look, the production values on this are going to be off the charts. And it was very well cast too. They found some people. You can tell when I wrote this, I had just read an article about pickup culture. These guys who, you know, have these ways of picking up women and everything, which would be fine, but a lot of it is really douchebaggy. They're big on negatives. Like, you know, you're basically putting women down to make them feel bad, and then you slip in some compliments so to bring them to your side. It's very manipulative, and everything. So I'm like, well, this is just perfect for a protagonist that we don't care about. You know, someone who's going to get their comeuppance.
A used and car salesman type personality.
yeah, you're right. This is very much. I mean, I was a big fan as a kid. It was before my time, but I got to read copies. EC Comics. I've always been a fan of good and evil gets punished. Occasionally it wins. I mean, almost every 70s movie ended with, you know, the bad guys winning, or the girl turns out to be a vampire just when you think they got away from all the vampires. How many 1970s movies end with the camera pans over and all of a sudden the character jumps at the camera with fangs? It's like, yeah, okay, great ending. But I like, if there's good and evil, I want it to be clear who's good, who's evil. And you got to watch out, because payback's a bitch. So here, to me, was a perfect character for that. And just getting dragged into it. But man, it's so beautiful. And the effects by Joel Harp and Siraj Davis. I'll never forget. I was there at the filming, the last scene, which we filmed at a castle. It's a little castle that they have somewhere in North Carolina used for weddings and stuff. We're down in the dungeon. And I got to see the monster for the first time in all her glory. And I just, you know, my script was just, she's a snake woman. I figure, you know, what I would do, if I were doing it, it would have been like cream makeup and scales and fangs, and maybe we could afford some lenses or something. They made silicon appliances, and they went in a way that I did not think of, but was so much better. And that to me is, that nothing makes me happier than if someone takes an idea that I have and improves it. Because I think that's part of what being a teacher is all about. You know more than your students, but wouldn't it be great if your students took this information that you gave them and go on to win the Nobel Prize in something? I mean, that'd be wonderful. They made her something from a tropical rainforest, the colors and everything. And the actress herself was not really an actress. She hadn't acted before. She was a dancer.
Well, that's the best kind. That's the best ones to get for monsters. To me, you always get somebody that's a professional dancer.
Right, because the makeup hides a lot of your features, hides a lot of your ability to really emote and things. But if you're someone who's trained to use their body to tell a story. So, yeah, it all came together, and I'm very proud of that thing. I had high hopes for it, and this doesn't happen often, but it exceeded them. It just came out better than I imagined, and certainly way better than I would have done. I think a lot of screenwriters there are like, yeah, that's not what I wish I'd been the one doing this. I'm glad Brett told that story, because that's about as good as it's ever going to get. Very, very proud of that one. And it did quite well on the festival circuit.
What I loved about it.
They even liked it.
I'm sorry, you go.
I was saying they liked it in Europe too. They liked it in Europe, and that doesn't surprise me, because Brett is very much a fan of that giallo, very stylistic approach. He's also got the ability to pull it off.
What I loved about the female character, when you see her early on, I'm assuming it's contact lenses with her, but they gave her which the Meg Foster eyes. Because Meg Foster had those eyes which just were so which were bluer than blue or whatever the color she had naturally, and I'm looking at her thinking, I'm sure that's contact lenses, or could she be like Meg Foster, just have those eyes that you always think are not, they can't be real, but they're real.
Right. They just the pale eyes, and you know, Meg Foster. If you ever get to meet her at a convention, because she does a lot of conventions and stuff. I'm saying, you know, Meg Foster, Dee Wallace Stone, Adrienne Barbeau, they have aged because, like all of us, they have gotten older. And you can try to fight that. You can use cosmetic surgery and everything else, but there's only so much you can do. All three of them are beautiful. You know, you can be a beautiful 60-year-old person. You can be a beautiful 70. You can be a beautiful at any age. I think if you try too hard, and I'm not going to pick on anyone. There's a few names that I could easily throw out. There are obvious choices. If you try too hard to stop that, you end up looking weird. Like, what role can you play if you've got this strange puffy baby face on, you know, an old neck? You know, just accept it. Accept it. Yes, if you're 60 years old and you get all the cosmetic surgery in the world, they're still not going to cast you as a 20-year-old. So what will they cast you as? You don't look like you're 16. You don't look like you're 20. Go with it. Now, having said that, please don't write me angry letters. I do understand. It's a whole lot different to be a woman in Hollywood than a guy. You know, Clint Eastwood can just keep getting more and more grizzled. And they're just like, yeah, look at him. Now he's like an old man. He's still fighting gangs and stuff and everything. And yeah, they're not quite as kind when an actress that, you know, was renowned for her youthful beauty is now looking like a 60-year-old woman, which is what she is.
Yeah.
That's, you know, the harsh realities of Hollywood. It's not nice.
It's a youth industry. Even people that are behind the scenes, they want young people. It's constantly they want the young. And because I've talked to directors and other people that are behind the scenes, and they're careful about, they'll tell me, not on recording, but they'll tell me, like, hey, it's a youth culture. We got to be careful how old we look and that kind of stuff. Because once they get you thinking you're old and they think, oh, you're old, you're not the hip, you're not the new, and that's what they want, the next new thing, not the next old thing.
Unless you're Ridley Scott and you're like 80 years old and you're making a masterpiece like, you know, Fury Road. Yeah, it's true. It's Hollywood is, you got a love-hate relationship with it, because I have friends who are actors and want to break into the business, and they're good enough. They're as good as the people I'm watching on these films that are earning high salaries. But it's not a meritocracy. And I think that's one thing that would have kept me from ever really pursuing filmmaking as a career. I don't like non-meritocracies. I worked as a chemist. And if I'm not saying I was a great chemist, but if you are a great chemist, you will never lack for a job. Companies will fight for you. Universities will desperately want to get you. A good chemist will always have a career because it's a meritocracy. The best chemist gets the best jobs. That's not true in Hollywood. You may, the best actor, the best actress, the best screenwriter in Hollywood might be the person who gives you your Starbucks cup. That's where a lot of them end up. And they're just waiting for that break. And that break isn't getting better. It's having the right pair of eyes see you, or you happen to walk into the audition and you're what the filmmaker imagined this character would look like. And you may get the job, even though this other person over here was way better at acting. They didn't look right. They have very specific things. But again, that's just the nature thing. So what I would suggest for people who, you know, hear that and are very depressed because the odds of success as an actor or actress are not that great, even if you're good, don't put all your eggs in one basket. Learn another aspect of the craft. There's nothing that says if you're an actress that you can't also know how to hold a camera or edit, or which is, by the way, editing is one of the secret things that no one seems to give any credit for. The editor, for my money, may have more power than the director. Editor can take a mediocre film and make it great, and they can definitely take a great film and make it mediocre.
Oh, yeah.
So
there's one other film I want to talk to you about, and that's the one that I rented on Amazon Prime. It's the one you brought up earlier, Blood of the Mummy, you know, and that kind of thing. And you did the effects, and you're in it as an actor. You get to play a stretch, I'm sure, a scholarly type. You're a psychiatrist. I think you know your niche, you know. It's like it's. I've seen you in other stuff where he's the teacher. Wow, that's really stretching far for me.
Yes. Okay, so that's the thing now. I will get emails from like friends that are making movies like, we got a role for you. And it's like, it's usually a professor type, a doctor type. And that's fine. Hey, because those characters show up in a lot of things. They usually don't have a long role, which is perfect for my schedule. And they usually die horribly, which I love doing. And I definitely died horribly in this one. So, but on this movie, I had one really big advantage, which is that there is a young makeup artist, Sierra Dahl. Yeah, you can find her on Facebook. I think she's probably the most naturally gifted artist I've ever run across, like way better than she even gives herself credit for, and can do amazing stuff with very little. So it's been a real pleasure. So much more talented than me. I feel absolutely no embarrassment in saying that, because she's so talented. It would be unlikely there are very many people who could say they were more talented than her, but way more than I am. So I had her tremendous contribution on this film. That was good. We had a mummy. We had a few different people playing mummies, but one of them was like 6'7" and thin as a rail. So that's an advantage. So mummies. Let me tell you this. When we decided we're going to make a mummy movie, I'm like, oh, this is going to be great. I was afraid she was going to say werewolf. Because if I had a good werewolf costume, I'd make nothing but werewolf movies. Werewolves are so cool. But there's the rub, a good werewolf costume. And if you look at most werewolf movies, a pretty high percentage of them, the werewolf costume would barely qualify as like a mascot. You know, they're terrible. So they keep them in the shadows, which is a really good move, because otherwise you're aware of how bad they are. Mummy, it's like, how hard can a mummy be? You just wrap them up. Okay. It took 6 hours. 6 hours that we got it down by coming up with shortcuts. We got it down to maybe 5 hours. but it was never, ever easy. And 6 hours is a long time for someone to be doing it. We learned, you know, by the time we got them wrapped up, they were had to go to the bathroom or something. It was, there was a lot of problems here. And unwrapping them took almost as much time. So by that point, we usually just cut them out of the suit, which meant we had to start all over again. You can't use the suit over and over again. There's no way to wrap up a mummy that doesn't, as soon as they start moving, it all falls apart. Because mummies didn't move. So it was pretty easy to wrap up a dead body. But as soon as they start moving, there's parts that don't come together. So we had to come up with all kinds of things. I had to go in there, talk about fixing and post. I had to go in there for a few shots, frame by frame, and take out parts where you could see the undersuit and stick in some artificial bandages and stuff to hide all this. And even then I can still see every now and then we use safety pins because otherwise it would fall apart. And I had to go in there and see if I could see a safety pin. I would clone it out. If I watch it now, all I see is there's a safety pin I missed. There's an obvious safety pin I've taken out. I can see the floating blur effect. It kills me.
See, now you've added something for repeat viewers. They can go, okay, after they watch the movie, then now go find the safety pins.
Take a drink. Every time you see a safety pin, you'll be dead by the halfway mark. But boy, that's where it all kind of came together. It was the most drama-free production we've had because unfortunately, there was some drama. There's always some drama. It's hard to do. When we make films, it's a year-long process because we're shooting on the weekends, and you can only do so much. This is everyone's side thing. It's like herding cats. Even though we tried to have a small cast, it still ends up being a pretty big cast. It was tough, but really things were with us. Like we found an escape room that was a mummy theme. It was an Egyptian-themed escape room. They had three different rooms, well-lit and everything, and that's where we shot the tomb of the mummy, and it looks so good. The color, the lighting and everything, these new digital cameras can capture lighting so well. And so that gave us a production value that was way beyond what we wanted. We had the character who played the older protagonist, the older Louise, turned out to be a terrific singer, besides being a fantastic actress. She was also a really good singer. And so we had a scene set in a nightclub that we've worked with before for showing films. And that came out better than I could have imagined. I love that song, actually. Everything worked. Everything just really worked well with this. We had a lot of fun. It's the last one we've done, partly because COVID hit. And then there's also, I don't know, there's a part of us that's like, is this where we stop? Is this where we say we did a film? It's probably the best that we've done technically, and it all worked and everything. It's like, you know, are we going to be able to do better? And also we're all getting older, and the thought of an entire year on one project becomes more difficult as you get older and you have to sort of pick and choose your projects. I think I've got, you know, in terms of writing novels, I mean, retirement is on my horizon. It's not happening anytime soon, but it's there. It's looming.
It's on the cusp.
And then, yeah, it's on the cusp. And actually, the last few years, it was so hard for teaching and everything. It's gotten better since the kids have come back, of course. But still, it really kind of took a lot of the momentum out of things. And I think about writing and everything, and I think I have more ideas than I have time to write them. So you got that when you get to that point, you have to start picking your projects carefully. And thinking about what you have time for. And then there's family things that come up, family obligations, good and bad. So, you know, it's tricky. Making a film is often, people would say, making a film is a young person's game. Because that's usually when we have a lot of time. At the same time, as you get older, hopefully you've learned a lot and you got a bit of wisdom and watched enough movies that you sort of inherently know what makes a good shot and what doesn't. So I kind of like, I also sort of like what Christine was doing with bringing up a new batch of people or finding someone like Sierra where she's got all these cool ideas and way more talent than I do, but I can tell her, here's some shortcuts, here's some things you can do, and then watch her take these little things that she probably would have learned on her own, but it might have taken some time, and then take them and run with them and just do way more than I ever could. She's very modest. way more modest than she should be. But, you know, she's got a great future if she decides to pursue this. It is sort of fun. I mean, we're kind of older, and yet a lot of the people that we've worked with on these projects are younger. But that's cool. That's really, that should be the, that's sort of the right role for creative people as they get older. Give what you've learned to younger folks and maybe save them the wasting time learning that. And then watch them, because now they've got the one advantage, the greatest advantage anyone can have, which is time. And go on. It shouldn't be one of those things where people are hoarding their skills and talents and all, because it's everyone's benefit. The more people we have making good films, the more people we have who know this is what you should do and everything, the more we all have to enjoy.
Yep.
You know?
And one thing I want to ask you, you might not know the answer to this, but I'm curious.
I'll just make it up.
Well, when the protagonist was in high school, they were showing the party scene at the pool, and she goes to karaoke, and of course they pick it, and of all the songs to pick, you know, for like I don't know where they had karaoke of this song, but "Beautiful Dreamer," and I was wondering if that was a homage going back to Mighty Joe Young.
That's what I thought, because Mighty Joe Young is one of my favorite movies of all time, but actually, it's an homage to copyright law, because it's one of the few songs that is that people know and you can actually use. Let me give a warning to any filmmakers out there. There is no bucket of syrup more likely to get you in trouble than messing with music, especially if you make the huge mistake of like doing a Led Zeppelin or something. The wrath of God is going to come down upon you. Copyright laws for music are brutal. Brutal stuff. You know, other things will fall out of copyright, but not music. You've got to go way, way back. And that was, one of the few. Stephen Foster's music is in the public domain. And that's about it. Anything else that you want to use, you'll get in a world of trouble. And it may, they could come and just say, erase the film. Listen, Hollywood Productions have had this problem. Well, I just watched for the podcast Love at First Bite. And one of the few things I remember really liking about that movie was the dance sequence with I Love the Nightlife, Love the Boogie. Okay, out of the film. They had to take it out, because when they bought the rights to these films for the movie, they had no idea that there was going to be video and DVD. And Disney found this out to their great distress when Lady and the Tramp, they had to go pay Peggy Lee a fortune for them to be able to release it on videotape. And that's why if you ever work for Disney, when you sign a contract, take a look at that contract. It reads like something from Scientology. You are signing over your rights for the next 5 billion years. And your stuff can be put into all known formats and all formats yet to be invented. If they invent a way to implant a chip in your head and play Disney stuff, you're not going to get an extra dime from it, because you have signed away every right conceivable and all rights not yet conceived. It's an ironclad contract. So be careful with music. Be real, real careful with music.
Well, at least it's nice to know I wasn't the only one that fought that. You know, you fought the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. I love, because I'm a big Ray Harryhausen fan, of course. So that was his first major film. He did about 80% of the animation on Mighty Joe Young. Beautiful stuff, too. And yes, that was a wonderful sequence with him holding up the actress and all. What a great movie that was.
It is.
And they were able to get so much emotion. Listen, I'm not too proud. There's a couple of scenes in movies that not only do I choke up watching them, but I got to be careful even talking about them, because I will start to tear up. And one of them is the ending of Mighty Joe Young. When he rescues the little girl from the burning orphanage. That has been affecting me since I was a child. I remember watching it for whatever reason in upstate New York on Thanksgiving. So this is part of it. It brings the nostalgia of being with family, including a lot of family that's no longer with us. We would go to my grandmother's house, and Channel 9 would show gorilla movies all day for Thanksgiving. I don't understand the connection, but it was usually King Kong, Son of Kong, Mighty Joe Young, and King Kong versus Godzilla. That was it. That was the four movies they would show. And of course, we were plastered right in front of the giant black and white TV set watching these films. And yeah, the scene where this little puppet rescues a little girl who also is just a little puppet, but she looks so much like my youngest daughter when she was that age and everything. That just kills me. I love that scene. That is, it is so marvelous. And it just shows the magic of filmmaking that none of this is real. It's even less real than most things that aren't real aren't real. There's no giant gorilla. There's no little girl. The fire is composite. This is completely made up. And yet you are with it for the whole thing. And yeah, if it's done well, if any creative thing is done well, it can really, you know, hit you in the field. And that's a cool thing. I hope that the stuff I've worked on and all that, you know, people enjoy it while they're watching it. That's great. And if it lingers for whatever reason, that's even better. And if it inspires some people to go out and do it themselves, even better. Best yet, you know. And that's the really cool thing. I know Christine shared that with me, that she's gotten some things from folks who, you know, just played a little bit role in our films, and then they really liked it. They went on to create their own stuff. That's wonderful. That's the best thing you can do. You know, pay it forward. Keep this going.
Oh, I agree with you.
And I never should have talked about Mighty Joe Young. I'm really like, oh, okay.
Well, it was my fault for bringing it up because of the song, but it happens. Yeah. But Blood.
How would you know?
How would I know? But Blood of the Mummy, though, I enjoyed it. And for listeners that haven't seen it, it's like we said, it's available for $2. You can rent it for $2 on Amazon Prime.
A bargain at half the price.
You know, or you can rent it for a couple bucks more on HD on Amazon Prime. And or better yet, you can purchase it and then you can watch it multiple times instead of just the one or two times on 48 hours.
You can keep rewinding to the part where I get my eyes bugged out of my head. Which is a funny story there. We did that, and it's an old trick. You put tubes on the thumb of your mommy or whatever, and then they fold their thumbs as they press against your eyes. And seriously, if anyone is like making a movie and they are not sure how to do special effects and they're afraid that maybe what they're doing is a bad idea that it might hurt someone, please look me up on Facebook. My avatar is the robot chicken, Bill Mulligan. And I will talk you out of using like real fire, or God help us, firecrackers as bullet squibs or something. I'll send you to where you can go to get better assets. Please be careful. If you're doing something like where an actor is being choked, okay, the trick to it is the actor who's doing the choking is doing nothing but holding their hands there. And the actor that's being choked is pressing themselves into the choke. And they control then how much pressure is being put on their neck. Because it is not possible, especially if you're wrapped up in mummy bandages, to really know how much you're hurting someone. So you don't hurt them. You put your hands in the right spot, and you let the actor who is supposedly being choked, they control how much is going on, how much it hurts, how much pressure. That's way better. So the same thing. We have the thumbs tucked in. There's some tubes in there. I press my eyes against his thumbs, making sure it's not too much, because these are your eyes. And then we pump the blood like crazy. And this is soap blood, because we were shooting in a place, it wasn't our place, and we had to clean up everything afterwards. And fake blood is usually very stainy. The stuff you buy in the stores at Halloween, you could stain Teflon, it's the worst. So I make up my own blood. I'll give you the blood formula if you want, it's no big secret. But it's soap. So it's pouring down my eyes, it's going into my mouth, oh, awful. And I'm screaming and everything, waiting for Christine to say cut. Now, God help, I love Christine, but man, she will hold a shot forever, because I want to make sure I got enough to cut with. I'm like, what the fuck? Finally, she cuts. And I'm like spitting out all this soap blood and everything. And in the background, I hear her say, oops. I can't see, of course. My eyes are cut. I go, oh, whoa. And like, you know, the wrong button got pressed. So it had to clean me all up as I'm bitching at her, and shoot it again, and it came out fine. But on the way home, I remember driving on the way home, two things. I started spiking a fever, and I discovered that actually eating soap, yeah, eating detergent will cause fevers. For any of you kids who are trying to stay home from school or something, you know, don't do this. I'd swallowed enough of it that I guess I was starting to get. And the other thing, and worse for me, is I'm looking at my hands, which had been covered in this soapy blood. It had just sucked all the oil out of my body. And I'm looking at my hands, and my hands look like, they look like a mummy. They were so wrinkled and nasty looking. I'm like, oh no. Like, I need some tonal leaves or something. It was the worst. Oh man, but that was a fun shoot. Oh, the other fun thing was one of the fake eyes that fell out of my head fell down an elevator shaft. And so I went down to the bottom stairs and got the elevator doors open. I'm looking up and there's the elevator. I'm like, okay, I can see there's the eye there. So I jumped down there and I'm getting the eye. And I found out later, Sierra told me she had come this close to like pressing the button to have the elevator go down. There was some reason why that would have been a perfectly logical thing too, because no one had thought to tell her, oh, by the way, Bill's down there at the bottom of the shaft. And I would have been okay. As long as because there was like a barrier. I think they realized some idiot would probably find himself in this position. If I had been smart enough to just get down low, I would have been okay. But I'm stupid enough that I might have tried to get out and then been sliced in half, which, as bad as that would have been, you know, that is the kind of thing that makes you a legend among indie filmmakers. You're like, you know, oh, yeah, Bill Mulligan. Oh, yeah, Bill. And everyone's like, the guy tells the story. It gets worse and worse every time, you know, although I don't know how to get much worse than being sliced in half by an elevator.
And the director kept being the cinematographer. You didn't even get the footage.
Get it in. Yeah. I mean, we can't bring them back, but at least we can use them. And you know what? I would be fine with that. I don't think you're allowed to actually use actual death footage in films, but that would, oh man, that would be traded for the next 100 years. Kids would be watching that, faces of death when their parents are asleep and everything. Oh, hey, got to watch this tape. This is where the guy gets cut in half by the elevator. That's not real. Look at him scream. He wasn't that good an actor. It's totally real.
Or they'll say he's overacting.
Yeah. Come on, you big baby.
Oh, it's so obviously fake. You know, look at that. That's not the way it looks, you know, even, and it's real.
I'm not sure how long you would actually live if you were cut in half, say at waist level by an elevator, but I have a feeling it would be long enough for me to be aware that, you know, this was definitely the worst day of my life and the last, most likely. Yeah. I don't think there's any coming back from that one.
Well, you know, but the good thing is that didn't happen.
It didn't happen.
And that kind of stuff. But Bill, I want to thank you for joining me to talk for a couple hours about your movies and movies in general and rather other topics that came in and out of our conversation.
Yeah, I'm a talker. I mean, this is what I do for a living, is I talk in front of a class, and unlike my class, you know, you're actually engaged. I love going to conventions. So you can find me at a lot of conventions in the area. I'll be at Dragon Con. And I'm going to be doing more conventions when the book gets released, because that's one of the ways you market things. If you're a writer these days, you are expected to do a lot of your own marketing.
And how can people get this book? It's come out April 21st.
Well, right, not yet. Not yet they can't, but get it on your bookmarks. In fact, go to Falstaff. Let me just double check to make sure that it's not falstaffbooks.com. Yes, it is. Falstaffbooks.com. FALSTAFF. Books.com. And I'll tell you, of course, I want you to buy mine, but this is a really good publishing house, and they have a lot of great stuff. And two I want to mention just off the top, give you an idea of the sort of thing they have. One's called Steel Mill Vikings by Sarah Joy Adams. And it's about a single mom who is a berserker, a Viking berserker working at a steel mill in that area. And I think, what was it, Buffalo or somewhere around there. It's cool. I mean, if you're a fan of things like the Dresden Files, that sort of urban fantasy, they publish a lot of really good books, a lot of books by new writers, diverse writers. There's another one I actually love by Sarah Suber, Fairy Godmother. And this is one of those things, as soon as I heard the premise, she's like a fairy godmother goes on a murder spree when someone kills her charge and is, you know, seeking them out. And that'd be the worst person to have on your tail. Good stuff there. There's a lot of good things to read. Falstaff Books. And hopefully, so in the next couple months, you'll see Raum, R-A-U-M. And that's by me. And I hope you enjoy it. But thanks so much for letting me come on. This has been a lot of fun.
And also, people can listen to you and see you on YouTube Decades of Horror. You can go to two different podcasts they have. They have the 70s and the 80s. And on a rare occasions, Bill does show up at the classic era. And you
sometimes
can,
if they're doing a Mario Bava film or something, they usually bring me on because they know I'll be enthusiastic about it. He's my favorite director.
But otherwise, listeners, you can follow him that way. Follow him on Facebook if you have questions. Like he said,
sure.
Message him, let him know. If you have questions, if you have feedback you want to send for this episode, send it to us at diecastmoviepodcast@gmail.com or leave us a message on the Facebook page. And I want to thank you all for listening. And go see Blood of the Mummy. It's on Amazon and a lot of his other stuff you can find on YouTube. And get the book.
Thanks so much, man.
I'm writing a book on how to kill vampires. I'm going to call it How to Kill Vampires. You will be happy to know that you are number 400. Oopsie daisy. I wouldn't struggle if I...
You and your dead god will fall before us.
Now, who might you be, little one?
Look at me.